All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world, leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Peyton Davis, winning, post-traumatic winning. We're not content with growing, we're Marines, right? Yes, that's what I hear when I hear her voice. I text messaged her. I said, how do I find the lyrics for this thing? I know you're singing about a cigarette at one point, but... So she sent me the lyrics. My lyrics were way better. Not even close to hers, but... I love the harmonies, especially this part of the song.
But right now it's just me.
Took police to check on her father, and they found that he had committed suicide. An artist in Nashville, Tennessee.
Without any questions, run into danger and show no emotions.
Winning, okay? Winning.
Wipe your lips off my pain.
You got to process it, get your hands around it. You're never getting over it. And then you got to touch the lives of other people. That's winning. Post-traumatic winning. I invented it. I stole a bunch of concepts from other people, but I invented that term. Because we're Marines, man. We're not coexisting with shit. We're going to boot that bitch right in the face and get after it. Because that's the way we do it. Okay, so John Ripley. We're going to change gears. We're going to change gears from that to John Ripley. I want to read the eulogy that his son read at his funeral by his son, Tom Ripley, right, who's a Marine officer. I'd like to say at the start of my remarks our father's favorite prayer. God, please do not let me screw this up. Amen. As I look out in this chamber, I see some of the nation's greatest warriors and patriots. Our father addressed each of you as his friend, family, and fellow Marine. All equal terms in his book. I want to thank you for coming to honor our father. Our family is deeply humbled by the outpouring of support and your condolences. Our father taught me that leadership is a contact sport. You have to personally engage your Marines. This turnout is a testament to John Ripley's style of leadership and for that matter, his style of friendship. My father is part of two great institutions, the U.S. Marine Corps and the United States Naval Academy. I would like to take this opportunity to thank the Commandant, General Conway, and the Superintendent of the Naval Academy, Vice Admiral Fowler. When I was a newly minted second lieutenant, one of my basic school instructors told me that my father is worth 1,000 men. He could see from my expression that I did not understand, a look that I mastered as a second lieutenant. He responded that there was a fight and your father was going, then 1,000 men would immediately join him. It appears that instructor underestimated John Ripley. Family was always the most important thing in John Ripley's life. My siblings and I are living proof of this. We made plenty of mistakes as children, and if it were not for the bond of family, none of us would have seen 18. Our father gave everything to us. He never had a nice car, took individual vacations, or had lavish things. All of that went to our education and betterment. He was a selfless parent. Despite all of his achievements, we always knew that we were his greatest accomplishments. Our father loved history. A lifelong student and son of Virginia, he often closed his messages, notes, and speeches with a quote from Stonewall Jackson, Jeb Stuart, or Robert E. Lee. Every road trip as a child included a sudden stop at a real battlefield marker, or pause for a quick history lesson. This knowledge gave him a sense of perspective. He believed that he was located at Dong Ha for a reason, and that he had the tools and the training to blow that bridge. He passed on this perspective at every opportunity. When he would speak in public or private, it was always built on stories and lessons of the past. How many of you have walked a battlefield, toured a museum, a monument, or cemetery with John Ripley? The emotion was overwhelming and was only matched by his passion for the topic. History inspired our father, and his passion was focused on the courageous acts of Marines carrying out their orders. The tactics and details of history were simply a baseline to teach us about more important things. Our father's knowledge of the corporal, the PFC, and those overlooked acts of heroism was unmatched. It tells a great deal about John Ripley's character that he spent time to uncover these facts and chose to use them instead of other more well-known examples of courage and heroism. Faith always played a powerful role in our father's decisions. Faith is why John Ripley was always incredibly optimistic. When the odds were long, John Ripley wanted to be with you, and you wanted the same thing. His parting words to my brother and I as we matriculated into VMI were, just remember, they can't kill you. He took particular pride getting the underdog, a student athlete with questionable academics but great leadership potential, into the academy. John Ripley loved a good fight, and he was good at it. There are so many incredible memories and lessons that I have from our father. I want to leave you with a few of our favorites. And these are bulleted. Trouser pockets are not for hands. Officers with facial hair love to stand weekend duty. Always take the hard road. You will be tired, but you will be alive. There are two seats on the John Ripley train, on it or under it. When you use the kneeler today, do not rest your bottom on the pew. Kneel or sit, not both. The term skipper is only to be used for commanding officers of rifle companies in combat and ships at sea. I want to share with you the concept of a nickel a run. We never took normal vacations as children. In our house, it was 100% all the time, and this held true for vacations. We would drive all night to the beach and arrive at 2 a.m. In the middle of the night, we did that very normal family, what every normal family would do. We would go for a swim. When we went to Martha's Vineyard for a day trip, our father rented 5 bicycles, and we pedaled around the island. My entire family found out firsthand that it's 27 miles around Martha's Vineyard. I was 10 years old. While visiting Yosemite in the early spring, we all had to swim across the Merced River. And when we would go skiing, Dad would buy us all lift tickets at $20 apiece. The key was to get to as many of the run of the runs down the hill as possible, so that at the end of the day, you were at a nickel a run. I was 25 years old when I discovered that ski resorts served food and had warm lodges. In John Ripley's house, everyone had a job, and whining was not allowed. Idle hands are the devil's playthings. One summer, our father found us watching TV in the basement. He promptly cut the power cord off the TV to the TV closet to the set so that we could not splice the wires. Many of you do not know that my father is also a dentist. After years of complaining of the fact that I had to wear braces, I demanded that they be removed. To my surprise, my father obliged and removed them that day with a pair of pliers. I told you this is awesome stuff, honestly. I read this yesterday, and I should get him on to talk about writing this. Funny. You all know that our father loved being a U.S. Marine. Over and over in his notes, he says the same thing. To be a Marine is to be blessed. My emblem is the same as yours, and the same as the hundreds of thousands that went before me. They are watching us perform. I have to uphold the standards. My father's style of leadership was summed up on a card he gave me when I was commissioned. A Marine leader must, and again, these are all bullets on the card. The spirit of the attack, march to the sound of the guns. Boldness, you are part of the finest fighting force in the world, act like it. A receptiveness for taking risk. Risk comes with the job. And if you are not comfortable operating with risk, then you need to get into a different line of work. Endurance, mental and physical. Mental is far more important than physical. Decisiveness. Make a decision, Lieutenant! Exclamation mark. A sense of mission, a sense of duty. Mission first, Marine always. In recent years, the Marine Corps saved our father's life twice. And again, this is an amazing eulogy. One, the humor that he sews in, that John Ripley was a hard guy. He was physically a tough man. Right, and he was the first Marine ever inducted in the U.S. Army Ranger Hall of Fame. A recent, I think that's what they call it, Hall of Fame, maybe something else, but it's that. In recent years, the Marine Corps saved our father's life twice. The first time, our 32nd Commandant, General Jones, provided a helicopter so that our father could receive a transplant. Time was short, and when John Ripley needed the Corps, they came through in a way only the Corps can. The second time, few people know about. The road to recovery from a transplant is a long one. Our father was struggling. There was a commotion outside his hospital room as an army orderly tried to stop. This is what I think I love most about the Marine Corps. All right, this is me, not him writing. The Marine Corps has this fuck you attitude. Okay, of all the services, one branch has that attitude as a corporation. All right, when we set our mind about something, if you want to get in the way, right, you'll get the shit knocked out of you. Because we don't relent, right? And it's one thing to say that in a book. It's another thing to see it in combat, where you see the selfless devotion of Marines to each other. And, you know, and again, F-18 man and I were talking the other day, and he mentioned a Marine dove in to save another Marine in the Helmand River and drowned. They both drowned. I said, you know, I remember a story from 2004. We were berming the roads outside of Fallujah so that nobody could get out in a vehicle. If you were going to get out, you had to walk, which would allow us time to get them. So they were berming along the Euphrates River, a road, and the bank gave way. The armored bulldozer tumbles into the river, into the Euphrates River. his security guy with helmet, flak jacket, and everything, and weapon, dives into the river to save him. And then they both drowned. Years old, the rest of his life in front of him. Didn't matter. So, and again, I could sit here and tell you stories for hours like that. And so anyway, it's the thing that I love about the Marine Corps. That chip on your shoulder, that fuck you attitude, and when we point that in a direction, that's where it's going. You ought to get out of the way, because this is not going to end well for you. And I don't care if you're foe or friend. It's happening. And our history is replete with it. Anyway, our father was struggling. There was a commotion outside his hospital room as an Army orderly tried to stop the four Marines from entering. Moments later, the color sergeant of the Marine Corps entered with the battle colors of the Marine Corps. Okay, for those of you who don't know what that is the Marine Corps official flag, the battle colors, with all the streamers that have been placed on our colors since the Marine Corps was invented. Everyone for places like battles at Chapultepec, right, on the shores of Tripoli, all those streamers sit on that, our battle colors. It's a real thing. Okay. Moments later, the color sergeant of the Marine Corps entered with the battle colors of the Marine Corps. The message was simple. Sir, the Commandant, General Jones, says these colors are not to leave this room until you do. Those colors saved his life. While stationed here in 1985 at the Naval Academy, the Commandant of the Naval Academy, Leslie Palmer, died suddenly. Our father came to visit his friend prior to internment. He was shocked when he entered the room to find no honor guard with Captain Palmer. As a senior Marine at the Naval Academy, our father stood at parade rest by Captain Palmer for 10 hours. It was only after our mother called another Marine to replace him that our father would leave his friend's side. While serving as the director of the history of the Marine Corps, our father was contacted by an officer from a regimental staff in Iraq. The regiment was the 1st Marine Regiment. The regimental CP was hit by a mortar round, and the regimental colors had blood on them and were burned in several spots. Okay, this is a story I tell about General Nicholson, who was the regimental commander of RCT-1 at the time. It was a rocket that came through a boarded-up window, and it killed a communications officer, and it severely wounded Colonel Nicholson. He was blown into the corner. The battalion color, the regimental colors, the battle flag, fell on him there. It was covered with his blood. The officers questioned, what do we do with these colors, and how do we get new ones? Our father's response was classic John Ripley. Nothing. They're called battle colors. There was little question that John Ripley was a winner. Most of you do not know the secret of our father's success. If you have ever attended one of his change of commands, a promotion, or an award ceremony, you will know that at the end, he always thanked one person for his achievements, our mother, Moline. As many of you know, our mother is not able to attend today's funeral. It is said that behind every successful man is a woman that expects it. This was never more accurate than in our home. My mother loved being married to a Marine. She loved the Marine Corps. I remember at Camp Lejeune when our father would come home for dinner, she would politely ask him to go upstairs and change out of his uniform. I always thought that was odd. I finally figured it out. When passing out orders in the house, Moline did not want to embarrass him. Mom outranked Dad. Our mother Moline has always been the driving force behind John Ripley. In the future, I will tell my son about his grandfather, John Walter Ripley. I will tell him that John Ripley was everything that is good about being an American. He gave everything he had to his family. He loved his wife above all things. He was driven and eternally optimistic. John Ripley was a patriot, and he remains my hero. One defining trait, above all others, was that John Ripley was a U.S. Marine. How about that? Yeah, What an awesome eulogy. So I'll post the link to that if you want to read it again. All right. I want to play in his own words. You're going to hear John Ripley now. And this is him describing his actions at the Dong Ha Bridge. We'll listen to this. We'll take a break, and then we'll get to Big Ed. All right. Ed's a former Marine officer. We'll talk about his career, but Ed Nevglosky is going to join us. So he now a PhD type history guy. But in his own words, John Ripley.
I've been asked to talk about the probably one of the more memorable events that is associated with me, and that is the incident in Vietnam when I was an advisor with the Vietnamese Marines back in 1972. And that was the destruction of the Dong Ha Bridge at a tiny little village then of Dong Ha. Right at the end of March, I want to say around the 28th, the enemy began their attack in a massive scale, 200,000 North Vietnamese, supported by tremendous amounts of anti-aircraft weapons, Zhu-23, 24s, all of these are... I managed to get the bridge completely. Anti-aircraft SAM missiles, mobile SAM missiles, virtually everything. When the attack started, my battalion, which was south of there, was immediately sent north. All of us were sent as far north as we could get. I was in the 3rd Battalion, and we were told to go to Dong Ha and essentially await orders. We had no idea what was happening, other than the fact that the fire bases on both sides of us, north of us and west of us, were being overrun. This was a shock in itself. We simply couldn't imagine the enemy attacking in such a great force. They hadn't counted on the fact that the Marines had been told to, in the rough translation of the orders we received the previous evening, stand and die. That has a very clear, forward element of finality. Stand and die. The purpose of which was do not lose this village. It is too important. Well, when the attack came, the enemy quickly moved to the north bank. We had a large bridge there, which had been built by American Seabees when I was there the first time in 1967. And this was a very powerful bridge. It was built over strength to take the heaviest of traffic, notably tanks. It became quickly apparent that the only way to stop them was to destroy that bridge. I called back to my superiors and said, I must destroy the bridge. I remember very well, my superior officer was Lieutenant Colonel Turley, and he responded back. He said, Ripley, I can't give you that kind of authority. You have to go all the way to corps level, which was multi-division level, in order to get that sort of authority to destroy a bridge. And I can't give you that authority. However, you've got to do it. You have got to destroy that bridge. And he offered also, I will send up what explosives I can find. I said, send anything, because we have nothing. So, having arrived under the bridge, as it turned out, the engineers that Colonel Turley had sent forward had managed to get the explosives there. It's interesting to note that I had no idea how I was going to do this initially. And when I initially looked out over that river, the bridge, the challenge was virtually overwhelming. I thought, my gosh, how am I ever going to get myself out there? As to say nothing of carrying what turned out to be at least 500 or so pounds of explosives. So I put a satchel charge over each shoulder and reached up and grabbed the beam as it approached the south bank where I could actually reach up, and then I began kicking my way through the anti-sapper fence, a large amount of barbed wire concertina that was in place. I would kick my way through it. The other advisor was helping with that. He would pull the wire down while I tried to kick my way through. It turned out to be not barbed wire, but what we call German steel tape, razor wire. You probably have seen it. And it really sliced the back side of my legs and all the way up to almost to my belt line where I was wearing my webbing containing all of my equipment. And I also had my weapon slung across my back. Not the right thing to do, but I wasn't really at the best of judgment at the time. When I managed to get out over the fence, and I knew that I had a considerable ways to go to get from there out over the river to begin placing the explosives, I started along burdened with the explosive, plus my webbing and my weapon, which I had erroneously not taken off. And I began this long trip, and I had at that time been awake and fighting, continuous fighting, for 3 solid days and nights. No rest. You wouldn't actually engage the enemy at night other than by artillery and generally small arms, but nevertheless, you're awake and you're fighting. And so I was exhausted when I started. I also had not had any sort of sustenance apart from a sip out of my canteen during those 3 days. Nothing, not even a tiny little bowl of rice that we generally had 2 or 3 times a day. So that my body was run down. I was very exhausted, physically exhausted. But I had a tremendous focus on the mission, what I had to do in order to stop the enemy. I had a tremendous focus on the requirement, the obvious requirement that I do my duty, do it correctly, and that I could be counted on. When I moved from there out over the river, despite this commitment that I had taken, this personal commitment, my body seemed to be failing me. I was a fit individual, but because I had been run down over this period, despite being very fit, I could feel that this was going to be a very tough chore. And as I hand walked out, I began to rhythmically, hand over hand, I would say, I can recall so clearly, Jesus, Mary, get me there. And this rhythm, this simple little prayer, Jesus, Mary, get me there, and over and over and over. And the strength came. It just came. It was perhaps phenomenal. It's easy to explain, but it's not easy to understand. And yet it worked. For me, it worked. A perfect example of faith in action. And the result of your faith, no matter how strong, assisting you in a very physical way, in a very tangible way, when you really need it. Boy, did I ever need it. I had been raised in the church, a very faithful person, and I continue to be. But I never really made that association between prayer and your faith and the physical aspect of what it does for you. And I can't think of a better example than this. Not only did my faith permit me to accomplish this mission, to essentially get out over the river, swing my body up so that I could hook my heels into the beam and then muscle myself up inside this channel formed by two adjacent I-beams, and then place the explosives in place, prime them, drop down, swing over to the next channel, and make my way back and start all over again.
This part two, so bear with me. Actually, that what you heard was the Colonel Ripley's funeral on YouTube. So here's part two.
Wired. It took over 3 hours, and perhaps closer to 4 hours, to get all of this in place. The enemy was not happy about this. They were trying to get my attention the whole time. 30 caliber messages coming my way. And somehow, heaven knows how, they were never successful. At one point, I was so exhausted. This was in the last channel on the upstream side. And I was crouched into this little opening I've described on all fours. And you push your body outward to gain the purchase on each side to hold yourself in place. I had roughly 3 inches on the bottom of these flanges that my knees and hands would fit on. And on one occasion, I actually passed out. I lost consciousness. I'm not sure for how long, a couple of seconds, maybe a half a minute. And I suddenly came back into consciousness, and I'm looking straight down at the river. The river's flowing underneath me, and I suddenly couldn't realize where I was. Where am I? Why am I here? What is happening? And then all the noise from the firing, and I regained it quickly where I was. A tank on the opposite bank, an enemy tank, fired a round, and this round hit outside of the beam that I was adjacent to, not directly opposite me, but a little behind me, and the angle that it hit the beam was so severe that the round skipped off and slammed into the bank behind me, very close to the end of the bridge there. Of course, if the angle had not been that steep, it would have penetrated, and the obvious, I wouldn't have been here. But that was another incredible bit of luck, which I always say, luck comes from faith. And in this example, over and over and over, you never lose your conscious stream of thought. You're so busy you don't dwell on that, but you never ever stop thinking about the here and now and the reality. In my case, I thought constantly about my family and the terrible, terrible things I would do if I were eventually lost, which was a very clear reality, and I thought for certain that I would never make it out of there. And I could not, I simply couldn't get that out of my mind. I was constantly thinking about my 3 very young children and my wife and how my loss would affect them. And it was just more than you can imagine, the terrible feeling that represented. And yet, through this virtually continuous prayer, very simple, Jesus, Mary, get me there. Get me there. And the rhythmic aspect of that, you would have to do it to understand it the way I'm describing it. But what a huge difference it made, and it was successful. And the success, I like to think, came from that very simple prayer. Later, without going into a lot of detail, The bridge was destroyed. The enemy was stopped. In fact, they had not planned on that. They had no contingency planned for not getting across that bridge, and they were stuck on the north bank. In fact, they were jammed up. Fort Air Controller Airborne flying over us, whom I communicated with later on that day, my call sign was Leatherneck, and he said, Leatherneck, you've got a parking lot of tanks from here all the way to the demilitarized zone. And so they began to, some ships offshore came very close aboard and managed to range me, which means they could reach me with their batteries, and they began to destroy these enemy tanks, and the enemy never made it across, which was a phenomenal event, us stopping them there. But more importantly, they lost their momentum. They were able to cross the river upstream a week or so later, but not with enough force to make a difference. And the mere fact we had stopped them there, my battalion had stopped them there, they lost momentum, they weren't able to accomplish their mission, their attack failed, and the wonderful result of that I'd like to talk about. The great military genius, he is called, in North Vietnam then, was Vo Nguyen Giap, General Giap, the hero of Dien Bien Phu, who beat the French. He and Ho Chi Minh, but he was the head of their military, and he was considered throughout the world as a military genius, having beat the French in 1954 at Dien Bien Phu. Well, when he couldn't get his army through Dong Ha, they fired him. And I would like, I reflect on that every now and then. The entire French army couldn't stop you, but one bloody Marine sure did.
John Ripley, in his own words, joining me from, I believe he's in Quantico.
Yep.
Ed, how do you say the last name, Ed? There's a lot of consonants in that thing.
Yeah, it's a good Polish name, Nevglosky.
Nevglosky. So the Nevglosky. You make it sound easy. I'm trying to pronounce it earlier. I'm like, so many consonants, man. How do you do that?
47 years of practice.
First of all, not only are you a historian, but you're also acquainted with Colonel Ripley. Tell everybody about that.
Yeah, so I've known the Ripley family for a number of years, growing up in the Marine Corps, a couple different duty stations. I was good friends with his middle son, Tom Ripley. So Tom and I actually graduated from Camp Lejeune High School in 1989 when our fathers were stationed there at Lejeune. And then we stayed in touch over the years. But, yeah, so I probably met the Ripleys the first time back sometime in the early 80s.
All right. let's talk about you before we talk about him, Ed. So your dad's you're the son of a Marine. Tell us about your dad. What years was your dad in, and what did he do in the Marine Corps?
Yeah, so my father came in the Marine Corps 1964. He served 30 years in the Marine Corps. Retired as a Marine gunner. He was part of the first Marine gunner group that came back under General Gray's direction and selected 1988 and then appointed to Marine gunner in 1989. Mm-hmm. And that included going off to the basic school. But he was an infantryman, of course, by trade. Did all the standard infantry stuff as a young enlisted Marine and then made his way up. Was a first sergeant before he had become a Marine gunner. 1989, we were stationed at Camp Lejeune. I graduated Lejeune High School and decided to follow in his footsteps. I enlisted, went to boot camp, became a machine gunner, 0331. And after a couple of appointments and a reenlistment, became an officer, commissioned 1996, and then became an infantry officer after attending the basic school. And went out and did the standard infantry officer tour, second lieutenant, first lieutenant. I was platoon commander, Company XO down to 2-8. Then I went off to the basic school to teach for a couple of years as staff platoon commander, attended Expeditionary Warfare School, and then became a company commander in 3-8, 2004. Participated in operations in Haiti and a couple of deployments to Iraq as a company commander of Battalion OPSO.
With 3-8?
With 3-8, right, in both Haiti and Iraq.
Where, so in Iraq, commander. You're there in 3-8, sir, in what, 2005?
Yeah, in Iraq, 2005 as a company commander. We're in the Fallujah, Karma area. This was right at the tail end of the sacking of Fallujah, if you will.
Yeah.
And then we'd come back from that deployment August of 2005, and I moved up to be a battalion OPSO and went back to Iraq, this time to Ramadi, in 2006 as a battalion OPSO.
Yeah, I was working current ops for the 5th Marine Regiment in Fallujah when you guys were in Ramadi, and they would be shooting what's known as glimmers from a battery, an army battery that was at Camp Fallujah. So you'd be doing something, all of a sudden you hear, I mean, because these things, like, they make a fair amount of noise when they leave, and like, what the hell is that? Who's shooting what? You know, you go find out it's like 3-8's like dropping the train station. Or I mean, and again, I was in Ramadi in 2004, and we were essentially rubbleizing Fallujah, I mean, Ramadi in 2006. The fight was, I mean, you know, everybody knows Fallujah. Ramadi was a much tougher fight, and it went on for years, and 3-8 a part of that. And the battalion commander, 3-8 was who?
Lieutenant Colonel Steve Neary. He's now Brigadier General. I believe he's coming close to putting on his second star. Right. He's currently got he's the commanding general of the 2nd MEB down at Lejeune.
So where does that, when do you leave the Marine Corps? How do you, what do you wind up doing?
So my last assignment, I decided I was going to retire. I was a Lieutenant Colonel. Was the operations officer at the basic school, which was a great job, and
Let's talk about that. You and I talked earlier, you know, a couple days ago and yesterday, but I had the privilege of being at the basic school during a lot of people refer to as a renaissance of thought in the Marine Corps, spawned by General Gray, his own war fighting. Intellectual thoughts as put out in FM one, written by John Schmidt, John Kelly, you know, helping to edit and write that thing. And I remember Kelly had it, the whole thing laminated. He'd have it in the field with him. He had the pages laminated of this booklet. And you're like, what the hell has Kelly got? And it shaped, I mean, a lot of careers, and a lot of general officers came off that staff. And it's by assignment decision, certainly. It's not by fiat. But talk about the impact of the basic school, both when you were there as an instructor and then ultimately as an operations officer. It's an awesome school. It's one of a kind. Nobody else has one. And it's to their detriment, too, in my opinion.
Man.
The other services ought to do that.
The basic school is, as an instructor, is where you want to create the aha moment for the brand new lieutenant, whether that's in the classroom, around the sand table, out in the field. You're doing everything as an instructor to enlighten them, to introduce them to concepts, to doctrine, very rudimentary doctrine at the fire team, squad, and platoon, and into the company level. But you're trying to create the aha moment for them. And what I mean by that is you're trying to put them in various situations that forces them to use the training, the education they've received, and then apply it. And apply it in a manner in which the odds are not in their favor and it's not a sterile environment. You know, we try to make the classroom tough, try to make the sand table exercises tough, and then you go out to the field, and, you know, when you're out there, you're not only dealing with the human element of having an aggressor force against you, but you're also dealing with the environment as, the forested area, the heat, the cold, you're tired, you're hungry. doctrine still applies even in those different environments. And that's where you create the aha moment, whether it's personal growth and development or development as a leader, leader of a unit. That was, to be able to do that as an instructor was, it taught me a lot of things when I would then go back to the fleet to be a company commander about how you lead in different environments.
How easy was being a company commander after doing that? It was fun. You knew how to train. You knew how to teach. It was, to me, it was the greatest preparation, and you trained all the time, so you knew how to do it, and you knew how to extract the appropriate lessons. You were comfortable doing line fire. A lot of guys aren't when they go back because they've been away from it, but at the basic school, you were doing it all the time, and it was, I thought it was the best training to go back to
and
the operating
going to
course.
The basic school between your platoon commander and company command assignments. Being at the basic school, it's like you never even left the fleet. You got to relearn the things that you may have missed as a lieutenant when you went through the basic school. When you're back there as an instructor, you have to kind of look from the 50,000 foot level down at what lieutenants were doing there, and then think back to when you were a platoon commander in the fleet, saying, you know, now I know why I did that, and now I know why it was wrong. So you take all of those things and you go back to being a company commander. You're a couple years older. Say maybe 3 or 4 years older, but you're about 10 years wiser. And being a company commander coming out of the basic school was a great opportunity. I don't think there's much else in the Marine Corps that could have prepared me to take company command than having been at the basic school.
No, and you're so confident in, you're so confident in your abilities. And also, you've been counseling people. You've never stopped doing that. So you really get it. I like the way you phrase it. I phrase it similarly. I got a chance to learn the things through and through that I was supposed to learn the first time. But I got a chance to really study them with smart guys around me who made me smarter. And I absolutely loved it. In addition to, you know, I wrote there a bit and was involved. And again, we were trying to figure out when I was there, we were trying to figure out, how do we do this maneuver warfare thing? Like, okay, I got it, but how do we teach it? What are the things we need to do? And you heard all this shit that people said, but it's like, well, wait a minute. The Germans don't seem like skipping go naked military to me. We all can't be doing our own thing. So how does this, like, initiative, I got it. And I made up a word, teaching there, a coordinated initiative. And I used to say, you know, this whole maneuver warfare thing, an issue, right? Well, let me tell you, on the real battlefield, real lead really gets people dead. And if you're someplace where you're not supposed to be, guess who might confuse you for somebody you're not? The good guys. Yeah. And so uncoordinated initiative is bullshit. A professional, if it's important enough for you to deviate our combat power for, right, you better be coordinating it with everybody coming behind you so we can exploit your little bit of genius, okay? Also, we might be able to turn it off because there might be somebody else that's already headed for that, and we've accounted for it. So uncoordinated initiative gets people killed. It fritters away combat power. So you got to have a more mature understanding about what initiative is and what it's not. And
no, I agree. Initiative can work both to your advantage and disadvantage. Well, it depends on who's kind of read into your initiative and is following along.
We got a chance in that laboratory to understand that and really come out with a master's degree before we went back to being company command. How do you get pointed towards history?
Being that, when you're around the Marine Corps, you're engrossed by all the history, the traditions that come with being a Marine from, you know, the first day of boot camp all the way, you know, to your last day in uniform. But in addition to that, growing up in the Marine Corps, I was very aware of Marine Corps history very early on, not just my father's history and what he had experienced, but the people that were around me. For example, Tom Ripley, you're in high school, and I've known him beforehand, but, you know, in high school, you're at that age where you're really starting to understand your surroundings. And I had been reading Marine Corps history for years. And, I remember, you know, meeting Tom's father, Colonel Ripley, for the first time and putting him in the perspective of, wow, you're a historical figure within the Marine Corps. So I've always had this kind of deep passion to understand where the Marine Corps got its reputation from. You know, what were these events, you know, as a kid hearing things, you know, Tarawa, Iwo Jima, Incheon, Kaesong. I always used to hear those things around the Marine Corps birthday, you know, and I'm a young kid wondering, what are these places? What are these events? And I'm curious by nature, and I would always pull a thread. And then I'd meet my friend's parents, and I would be able to put together, oh, wow, so your father was here. Your father was this unit. Oh, your father did this. My father did this with your father here. It just became a passion of mine. And I just continued to read, and the Marine Corps, of course, always affords you the opportunity to read military history, and it just became second nature to me.
So how did you pursue it? You obviously go and pursue graduate studies in history. Where do you go? What do you do?
So for graduate school, I'd received my degree in history, my BA from East Carolina University or North Carolina, and I did that when I was stationed down at Camp Lejeune.
Okay.
Just hop up there different nights of the week and on the weekends and take classes when the opportunity was there. And of course, I'd always take classes out when we were on ship. You just get general elective requirements. Later on, I would get my master's degree through distance education through Norwich. They had a program, still do. It's a great program. It's top ranked in the nation. Master's degree in military history. We had some of their instructors at Camp Lejeune on base education. So I finished my master's degree through Norwich in military history. And then as I was nearing the end of my Marine Corps career and I decided I was going to retire, I applied for a PhD program, and I was picked up by King's College in London, and you know, in London, England. And the next thing you know, I'm all coursework is done. I'm writing a dissertation. Now the dissertation's done, and I've sent it in, and I'm waiting to defend and officially receive my PhD, and it'll be in military history. So I've always just, whether it's been through my duties as a Marine or off-duty opportunities, I've just always picked up a history book and read and wrote about what I've read.
All right. So I ping Chris Woodbridge, who's the editor and publisher of the Marine Corps Gazette, and I said, hey, I'm looking for somebody, because I wanted to talk about what took place during the Easter Offensive of 1972 at Dong Ha. I wanted to do some. I do these things called battle studies, and where I take map chips and I make them part of an interview, and then I bring somebody on who was there and talk about it. It's tough to find somebody who was there, right, for this one. So I asked Woody. I said, hey, could you point me in the direction of somebody who could talk? And he gives me Ed's name. So talk to us about how you got interested in Dong Ha, and obviously you know Colonel Ripley and the Ripley family. Talk to us about how you got interested in it.
Well, my personal interest goes back to Marines in Vietnam. I've always had a great interest in our experience there. My second cousin, Lance Corporal Edward Day, was a rifleman with Lima 3-3 in the summer of 68, and he is killed in action, receives the Navy Cross posthumously. I am named after him, so my parents named me after Ed a couple years after he was killed, I was born. So I knew that growing up that I was named after a Marine that was killed in Vietnam. So wow. My typical curiosity, I started going down the path of, wow, so what was my cousin doing in Vietnam? What were Marines doing in Vietnam? Marines in Vietnam became my thing probably starting around the 7th or 8th grade, and I just carried it all the way through the rest of my life. So in my master's program and in my PhD program, I've always written about Marines in Vietnam. As my capacity as a research fellow here at the Marine Corps History Division, I'm their Vietnam subject matter expert. So along with that comes knowing every single thing that you could possibly need to know about Vietnam, Marine operations there. And when it comes to Marines in Vietnam, almost one thing that rises to the top is, wow, that Marine that blew up the bridge at Dong Ha in 1972, that was amazing. So that was something that over the years I had always read about. Of course, I had known Tom being here at the History Division. I've been able to dive a little bit deeper into some of the documents and read the inner workings of what was going on. So I've been able to take what happened at Dong Ha and use both a personal and historical perspective of trying to analyze what happened, what went right, what went wrong, etc. And it just, I think the people around here at Quantico, whenever they have a question about that, somehow my name gets thrown in the mix, and the next thing you know, I'm talking about it like I am today. So really, it's been by personal experience and happenstance that I ended up becoming this, you know, guru on the Easter Offensive. And that's pretty much what's gotten us here.
There you have it. All right. Let me ask you just a liberal arts question based on something you said. I've learned in the 2+ years that I've done this a ton about Vietnam that I didn't know. And for instance, when you read about the fighting in 1967, 68, 69, just south of the DMZ, vicinity of Con Tien and east and west of that, when you read about those fights, those were straight up man events. You were fighting an enemy that would rocket, mortar, and artillery you, and then close with you. And their field craft was incredible because they knew, to use their words, they had to get you by the belt buckle, or else we would turn our supporting arms loose on them and we would annihilate them. And the stories that you read from their perspective now that some of them get written are amazing when they talk about the destruction of entire units by American firepower and what that was like to watch, you know, people dissolving in the fire of napalm. And so you read about those fights and it talk about holy shit moments. So my question is this, what do you think is the least understood aspect of Marine involvement in Vietnam?
That's a great question. I think the least understood, and it's very closely related to my dissertation topic, and that is that the Marines were fully engaged in the body count, conventional aspects of fighting the Vietnam War. And let me unpack that. The general historiography of Vietnam will always have on one side of the coin, the Army's big unit war, attrition strategy, General Westmoreland's, you know, desires to go after the main force and NVA elements and don't worry about the villages, we'll take care of the people later. Right. You have to provide security before you can win the hearts and mind. And then on the other side of the coin, general historiography will tell you the Marine Corps, General Krulak, etc., argued against that, saying, no, you've got to win the hearts and minds first, and then the asses will follow. And to a degree, that is true. But what I've discovered in looking at a lot of the documents that have been, for lack of better terms, declassified or released to the public over the last 5 to 6 years, is that the Marine Corps went into Vietnam, General Krulak included, and throughout the time that we're in Vietnam, specifically 65 to 67, 68 time frame, that we were fighting and with every intention on fighting this way, a very conventional general war type scenario. Our belief was, yes, protect the villages and protect the population, but when the opportunity presents itself, you know, man up and move into the hinterlands and attack the main force elements in the NVA when they present a viable target. And that's why you see the early years of Vietnam, our involvement there, 65 and 66, we're establishing ourselves in the population, and then all of a sudden, you know, we move into the hinterlands, west of Dong Ha, west of Chu Lai, west of Way City, and we start fighting in the mountains because the enemy is presenting a lucrative target. And our doctrine was protect the people, but when they present themselves, hit them. By 1968, it becomes a full-on slugfest, 68 and 69. At that point, we're not worried about the population anymore. We figure we've got the population won. Right now, the lucrative targets are presenting themselves at the cyclic rate, and we need to go into the hinterlands and destroy them. And that's something that I think historians can go back and look at. The Marine Corps, I am not dismissing the Marine Corps' efforts on using pacification and winning hearts and minds, but what I am saying is that was not our main effort. Our main effort, it was a balanced approach, and that's exactly what Krulak and General Walt and our Commandant General Green called it, the balanced approach. Protect them when you can protect them, but when the enemy presents himself, attack. And I think that's something that is it's very little has been written about it, and there's very little that's understood, and I think it's been dismissed. A lot of that has to do with the desire to sell history. You know, a good rivalry sells history. It'll sell books. So if you can put the Marine Corps on one side and Westmoreland on the other and create inter-service rivalry, people will buy into that. But in all reality, it was not that much of a divide between the Marine Corps and what Westmoreland wanted to do.
You know, also, you know, prominent among Vietnam authors is Bing West, right?
Yes.
And his writing about the village and maybe skewing even our own reading in that direction. Not that that stuff didn't exist simultaneously to the other things going on, but when you put them on a scale, it again, that's why to me Vietnam is so interesting, because you'll talk to guys and their Vietnam experiences were completely different.
Yes.
You know, depending on what you're, you know, again, it's kind of stupid because the same thing can be said in Iraq and Afghanistan. I remember seeing pictures of Marines painting curbs in Ramadi before they had a 5K run there or some shit like that. In fact, I was at General Nicholson's house having dinner, and he said, "Hey, Mac, check this out." And he hands it to me, and I said, "What's that?" He said, "They're painting curbs yellow in preparation for a 5K run in Ramadi." I said, "Sir, I didn't want to even look at it because I feel like the picture's going to explode."
Yeah.
I mean, because nothing good happened in Ramadi. Nothing. It was a terrible place. You know, and then people went there, you know, 2008, 2009. They were like, "Oh, yeah, we're at a 5K. I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" And so,
wasn't that way 2 years earlier, or three or 4 years earlier, that's for sure.
But I mean, the experience so different. Along the coast, fighting, you know, patrolling, and fighting the Viet Cong, and the insurgency thing, and then in the Central Highlands, in the mountain fights, around Con Tien, in the DMZ, you read those stories? Holy shit.
Yeah, you when you talk to guys, and I have done this, I've talked to Bing West about the village, and he'll tell you that's what his war in Vietnam was. I mean, it was the small unit war. It was corporals and sergeants running things. But then on the other side, you talk to guys like Colonel Dick Camp, who wrote Lima 6, his experiences. And Dick Camp will tell you, "I don't know anything about villages. What I know about is, calling for naval gunfire, close air support, and fighting up close and personal at Con Tien and Khe San." So he has no memories of villages other than, you know, the villages that got whacked, that got caught in between the massive engagements and supporting arms. So two completely different wars, and you're absolutely right. That's what makes it so interesting is whatever your preference is, you know, there's plenty of reading. If you want to read about CAP and pacification, plenty of it that the Marine Corps did. If you want to read about, you know, Iwo Jima-style assaults and taking large numbers of casualties in conventional warfare, there's plenty of that there, too.
My guests today, we're going to talk John Ripley. We're kind of talking a broader context of Colonel Ripley's exploits here that we'll talk about here in a few minutes. You heard Colonel Ripley, in his own words, describing, you know, "Jesus, Mary, help me," as he went across the Dong Ha, the underbelly of the Dong Ha Bridge. And my guest today is retired Marine, Nev Ed Novgloski. And
there we go.
And I stuttered. When I get nervous about a name, it totally, you know, it mind screws me. I clean that
up. That's why I go with Ski most of the time.
There you go. Joining us is Ski from the. Now, what's your official position at the with Marine Corps History Division?
I am the Edward North McClellan History Research Fellow at the Marine Corps History Division here at Marine Corps University in Quantico, Virginia.
Okay, so when I come back, I'm going to come back and I think broadcast from, at the week of the marathon. I'm going to do my show from, I think they have some kind of fan fest or something the days before leading up to the marathon. So I'm going to do my show there. When I get done with my show in the afternoon, can I come down and will you take me into the Holy of Holies and show me around?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I tell you what we got to do is try to get you over behind the scenes at the museum where you can, like, literally hold the last Navy cross that Chesty Puller ever wore, and it, you know, it's got the four stars on it. It's pretty daunting. Or you can actually hold Smedley Butler's last pair of, you know, Coraframe-type shoes that he wore. They've got all the official uniform items over there. Sometimes I walk into that place, and over here we have a lot of official documents, and we've got the historians that are full of things in their minds. You go over to the museum, and you're actually touching things, and you're like, oh, my God, you know, I can't believe I'm touching Smedley Butler's shoe.
You know what? Smedley Butler, an interesting guy, and he's become more interesting after my experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, and because I'm sympathetic to his path post Marine Corps, where he turned around and said, "Hey, this is all bullshit." And to me, he lives a very interesting life, where he's a warrior for his nation and he's a believer, and then he kind of goes around and he sees it and he says, "Hold on a second here, this ain't right." And so, it's an interesting guy.
Yeah, he got angry real quick. And there's a lot that goes with that. You know, his kind of belief was that he would become the commandant, and you know, his father was a congressman at the time, so he had all the political connections. He was good friends with John Archer Lejeune. And when he didn't get named Lejeune's replacement, he was kind of jaded. That's not to say some of the things that he was saying were incorrect, but I think there was also a little bit of animosity and disappointment involved as well.
All right, let's talk about John Ripley and Dong Ha. Give us an orientation to Dong Ha, and then talk to us about how Ripley gets there.
Okay, so Dong Ha is the really the largest, the easternmost town in the northernmost province of Quang Tri. So the five provinces that the Marines were operating in the I Corps, Quang Tri being the northernmost one up on the DMZ with North Vietnam, if you go straight down Highway 1, which goes all the way from Hanoi, north of Hanoi, probably into China, all the way straight down south of Saigon, along the coast of Indochina, Dong Ha is the easternmost built-up significant population center or town in Quang Tri province. It sits about anywhere 3 or so miles south of the demilitarized zone. And with Highway 1 there, makes it an avenue of approach, a very valuable avenue of approach. It is also the intersection of Highway 1 and Route 9, Route 9 being the major east-west route in Quang Tri province that would take you from the coast of South Vietnam all the way through to the western side of Laos. So Route 9 runs south of Khe San, goes through the mountains into Laos, and then all the way, it'll take you west. Now it is developed all the way to where it runs into Thailand.
Wow.
So,
but at the time, it runs what? At the time in Vietnam, it runs by Camp Carroll out to the rock pile?
It runs due south, right through Dong Ha, south of Leatherneck Square, Cam Lo, in Con Tien. It kind of dips down, goes past the Vandegrift Combat Base, Camp Carroll, the major artillery base, then it kind of loops back up and makes its way, continue west past Khe San, and then across the border of South Vietnam and Laos. It's a Route 9 is primarily a dirt road. Highway 1 is a mostly hardball improved road, but you know, there's some dirt segments of it. There's some gravel area, but it's a decent thoroughfare, you know, a decent way of traveling, vice going overland.
But at the time, Ed, it's the, if you're going to move armor for if you're going to move armor and you're going to move a lot of trucks, it is the route. Yes,
it is.
There is no other choice.
It is, in fact, and the enemy knew that, and that's why the French nicknamed the area between Way City, so the Fubai area, and a little bit south towards Da Nang and a little bit to the northeast, the French used to call it the Street Without Joy, because any time they got on Highway 1, you were going to be targeted. And in addition to that, the French established Route 9 running east-west. They had just as many engagements there. So it's the route you're going to use, Highway 1 going north-south, and then Route 9 going east-west if you're in Quang Tri province and in that portion of the I Corps. But the long and short of it is, if the enemy knows you're going to use it and you use it, they're going to hit you there. And the Marines used to have what we call the Rough Rider convoys that used to run the gauntlet on Highway 1 in Route 9 in the I Corps. And that's when we would send tanks out with trucks that were packed with sandbags and armor to deliver supplies to all the combat bases up on the DMZ, you know, Kantian, Kamlo, Kaesong. And that was you had to get volunteers for that mission. And like good Marines, we always had volunteers, but, you know, if you were a Lance Corporal that misbehaved, you might find yourself on a Rough Rider convoy running the gauntlet. So yeah, that area was significant for contact. And just to kind of sum that up is, you know, the intersection of Highway 1 and Route 9 is right there at Dong Ha. The bridge of Dong Ha is just north of the intersection of Highway 1 and Route 9. So if you want to seize that major intersection to stop forces from flowing east, west, north, south, best thing you could do is seize the bridge and then move across and seize Dong Ha. To block that intersection.
And in that offensive, I don't know that there was anything higher in terms of terrain objectives than those. There couldn't have been, because if we don't get this, we don't go. And even worse, if we don't get this and we're already poised to head down that road, mm-hmm. By the time the Americans react and we're lined up on that road, that's not going to be good. I mean, and you can have visions of the Iraqis fleeing out of Kuwait City and that highway of death scene. I mean, something like that.
Yeah, what's beautiful about Colonel Ripley is he had spent 1966-67. He already spent a year fighting in that area as a company commander with Lima Company, 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines. Ripley's Raiders is what they call themselves. And I had engaged in conversation several times with Colonel Ripley on this. You know, and it's in writing, he'll swear to you that the enemy never caught my company by surprise. We initiated 99.9% of the engagements because he continued moving. He never allowed himself to become complacent and tied to a piece of terrain. If he had the objective, his objective was to secure or control a piece of terrain, he would move around it and secure it or control it from different angles, different terrain perspectives. But his entire tour in Vietnam, and I think he did a 15-month tour up in that area as a company commander. He was very familiar with the northern province of Quang Tri and the Dong Ha area. So fast forward years later,
let me read you a bullet from his eulogy.
Okay.
His son says, there are many incredible memories and lessons that I have from our father. I want to leave you with a few of our favorites. And there's probably one, two, three, four. There's probably eight bullets. And here's one of them that directly correlates to what you're saying. Always take the hard road. You will be tired, but you will be alive. And it seems like he lived by that in Vietnam.
Oh, he did. You know, a close friend of Colonel Ripley and the Ripley family is the Carroll family, retired Marine Colonel J.J. Carroll,
right,
who both of his sons would go in the Marine Corps.
Right.
But I remember Colonel J.J. Carroll saying to me one day, he was like, boy, let me tell you about John Ripley. He was up there doing some crazy things. And what he meant by crazy was the guy didn't sleep. He took care of his Marines, mind you, always took care of his Marines. But he didn't sleep, and eating was a crutch. It was a privilege. He kept his boys moving, kept engaging the enemy. Wherever Ripley was, the enemy did not control the night. They did not control terrain. They did not control the initiative or the momentum. Ripley controlled it. And for Colonel Carroll, who I think the world of, to say that, you know, Ripley was up there running things, that means a lot. And Ripley would remember that when he comes back as an advisor. His appreciation for history, also his appreciation of his own experiences. One of the first things he would say when the Easter Offensive begins is, we've got to move east and we've got to secure Dong Ha. It is critical. And he was already recognizing, because of his experiences, what the enemy was going to do. And that speaks volumes.
All right, so he's now, to describe his billet, he's like so many guys who would become historical figures in the Marine Corps post-Vietnam. They were initially there as lieutenants or maybe captains, as platoon commanders or company commanders, and then they went back as advisors. Tony Zinni, Ray Smith, Tom Droughty, all these names that you hear have advising on their resume. Talk about Ripley. He's there as an advisor. How long has he been in country at this point? And what's he been doing?
Well, he spends his time there as an advisor. He does a full year plus when he's there. He gets there in sometime around late 71. The Easter Offensive, of course, picks up. There's action that's taking place in the months leading just after the new year. There's always problems around Tet. But April 72, when the offensive starts, Ripley has been in country probably close to 6 months at that point. He's very well liked by the Vietnamese battalion that he is leading, the Sea Tigers. And I think the battalion commander has the utmost respect, not just for Ripley as a Marine and a tactician, but Ripley as a man. He's very dedicated. You know, Ripley did not draw a distinction between leading Marines, U.S. Marines in combat, and leading South Vietnamese Marines. A Marine was a Marine. He was a leader, and he had a job to do. And I think the South Vietnamese Battalion Command really, really appreciated that, and it rubbed off on him. But Ripley had a great reputation among the other advisors. He had already seen quite a bit of action as an advisor leading up to the offensive. So when it kicks off, his advice and guidance to the company, South Vietnamese Company Commanders, and to the South Vietnamese Battalion Commander, it is without question gospel. And they're willing to do whatever he recommends. At the same point, he's willing to take their recommendations and thoughts and input and kind of assess and say, hey, that's a good idea, better than mine. So his reputation is impeccable with the South Vietnamese rank structure and the individual South Vietnamese Marine.
Interesting, his whole style of command. You don't hear that said often. Colonel Carroll's remarks. And I'll tell you, if you want to see a guy who looks like a Marine, go find a picture of J.J. Carroll Sr., right?
Yeah.
His kids are better looking than him. They're kind of pretty boys from the Carolinas, but especially his namesake, J.J. But, yeah, they're pretty boys. The dad, you walk around the corner and you walk into J.J. Carroll and nobody's making a joke, okay? Maybe his friends might, but if you were a subordinate, you're like, I don't know who this dude is, but I'm not screwing around when he's here. J.J. Carroll, yeah. And you don't hear that very often in Vietnam. You know, Vietnam where, you know, they were so comfortable, their field craft so good, in the jungle, and ours not so much. We fought as a counterpuncher, and then would not afraid to close with, certainly use our supporting arms, but with them, they didn't have the supporting arms. They certainly didn't have the aviation, although they did have obviously mortars and artillery and rockets that they would use. But they knew, again, to use that quote, if they didn't grab us by the belt buckle and stay close and then get the hell out of there, it was not going to be good for them.
Which is one of the reasons that Ripley kept his company moving so much as a company commander, and then later as an advisor, he would impress upon the South Vietnamese battalion commander, you need to do the same thing. If you keep moving and you don't allow them to close with you, you will always have the initiative. You will keep them from pinning you down, and you'll always be able to use your supporting arms. So he forced that upon, and I say that loosely, you know, he made that the one of the priorities for the South Vietnamese battalion. And they stuck with it, and that battalion was able to endure long after Ripley left because that had been ingrained in their psyche.
Wow. That's what a gift, right? As a warrior. What
absolutely.
Right, the gift, actually, the gift of life for a lot of people. So, interesting stuff. All right, so he's there. Tell us about the dawn of the Easter Offensive in 1972. Any indications? Hard to hide that much armor and that many vehicles. Did the North Vietnamese mask it well enough that it came off as a surprise, or did they know it was coming?
Yeah, I think Colonel Ripley would tell you, and a number of the other advisors, again, Walt Boomer, Ray Smith, Larry Livingston, all these guys, as you have already stated, will become, you know, if you're a Marine in the 80s and 90s, you grow up knowing these guys as leaders, as colonels and generals, general officers, and, you know, they walk in a room and you stand because they served as advisors during the offensive. I mean, these guys really made their name and cut their teeth. But they will all tell you that in the days leading up to the Easter Offensive, so you're talking around the 30th of March, maybe the 29th of March, they start to receive more than their fair share of artillery at a series of combat outposts and fire bases along the DMZ. And they notice that, you know, not just the numbers, but the specificity and how they work, these fire bases were being targeted and shelled. They weren't being targeted and shelled for destruction. They were being targeted and shelled to keep the Marines pinned down and not able to withdraw. So it was almost they were caught in a fire sack. And that would go on for two or three days. And then once the Marines are able to kind of pick their head up and look around, the NVA will unmask the armor and mech forces. Now, our aircraft were identifying them north of the DMZ and warning the guys on the ground, we've got mechanized and armor forces positioned up here, but they're static. They're not moving. Well, after two or three days of artillery, those guys would slowly creep, and then finally expose themselves. And by then, you know, armor and mech forces are right across the river threatening to cross the Dong Ha Bridge. There ain't much you can do at that point. You know, naval gunfire is effective. Using close air support's effective, but along with that mech and armor comes a whole slew of triple A, mobile and ground mounted. So our aircraft are now taking a beating trying to spot and target these mech forces and a lot of the artillery batteries that are keeping the Marines boxed in.
Okay, explain to everybody what triple A is, just in case some people don't know.
Yeah, your anti-aircraft artillery. So, you know, you've got your 23 TAC-4, which might be a multiple gun system, two or three 12.7 millimeter machine guns that are specifically designed to take out fast moving aircraft. And sometimes those, that goes from 12.7 millimeter up to 30 millimeter artillery rounds that shoot directly in the air to take out fast moving fixed wing aircraft. So there's a variety of them, but they can be either ground mounted and stabilized and static in place, or they can be mounted to vehicles and move around the battlefield for their own purposes of defense and mobility.
Okay, got it. What about, okay, so there is activity And probably like every one of these events that we see, depends on who you work, you're working for, and what they're saying about the activity. What's in Ripley's head? What does he think? He's no stranger to Vietnam. What does Colonel Ripley think is going to happen?
Colonel Ripley would tell you that he had, if you took the amount of artillery that and mortar fire and rocket fire that he experienced in his earlier tour in Vietnam as a company commander, that in those 3 days, it easily eclipsed what he had experienced in his previous tour combined. It was just massive. Ray Smith, who was an advisor there with Colonel Ripley, will tell you the same thing. He had never seen that kind of artillery, and he had fought in Way City. Ray Smith had, as well as up at Contien and Khe Sanh, he had fought down south in the Arizona Dodge City, the 1st Marine Division AO, and Smith will tell you they were pouring it on. They were saturating grid squares at a time. So there was destructive fires, but what they were really doing is keeping the Marines boxed in. Massive amounts of artillery and mortar and rocket fire. So Ripley will tell you that it was preparation for something big. How big, they weren't entirely sure, but it was clearly preparation for a ground assault. It was just not a matter of if it was going to happen, just when.
The interesting stuff. All right, let's talk about the events. Let's talk about the events of that day. And again, my guest today is Ski, otherwise known as Edward Nevglosky, a retired Marine, almost a PhD. is one of the endowed chairs at the Marine Corps Historical Division, and been gracious enough, who knew Colonel Ripley growing up as a father who was a Marine Corps gunner, and I don't mean a warrant officer, I mean a the Pinapalian tribe, okay? Those people, he's a pineapple guy, okay? And I've learned, do you know Mike Musselman?
I do, yeah.
He's another Pinapalian. Okay.
Yep. And recently retired himself last year.
Yeah, he comes on the program 4 days a week. And the guys who wore the pineapple often got confused that they were commanding generals. Okay. And you can't blame them for it. They live in a rarefied era of advising. And sometimes they get confused, or at least Musselman gets confused. Hey, Mike, do you know that you actually weren't commanding the division? Mike, Mac, some days you have to understand I was commanding the division. Okay, I'm done with you.
Musselman gets by on his good looks too.
Don't ever say that again. He's going to be with me at the marathon.
Well, great. Make sure you give him my best. I'm friends with him on Facebook. I haven't seen him in a couple of years, but yeah, anytime I do, it's a good conversation.
No, smart, fun guy, interesting guy.
Yeah.
Talk to us about the events of that day.
So, the Easter Offensive kicks off. You know, the first couple of days, April 72, by the first, second of April, the NVA have massed, and I'll kind of zero in around the Dong Ha area. They've massed a brigade, a combined brigade of, mobile AAA, armor and mechanized forces. So they've got some of the P-76s. Armored personnel carriers that can move across rivers. They've got those mounted just up on the Qua Viet River north of Dong Ha across the bridge. And they've also got a couple battalions of armor, and then of course again the mobile AAA. You're looking at about 20,000 NVA troops by around late on the 1st, early on the 2nd of April that have massed anywhere between right on the bank of the river to about 2 to 3 miles back. Some are on the road. And this is what's interesting. Some of the aviators will tell you that, hey, this wasn't a cat and mouse game. I mean, they had armor and mech forces off on the side of the road trying to seek cover, but they had a lot of them just lined up on Highway 1, exposing themselves and identifying their intentions. We're coming south. Ripley at the time is just to the west of Dong Ha, a small village. His battalion that he's advising, they're kind of spread out, so they've got to take a day to pull all the companies back in from their different assignments that they had been doing in the days leading up. Once they've got the whole battalion kind of put back together, they're looking at about 500 or so South Vietnamese Marines, maybe closer to six. Ripley meets with the battalion commander and says, we need to move east. We need to secure Dong Ha. We need to secure the bridge. And, of course, this whole time Ripley's talking to Colonel Jerry Turley, who's down at the Quang Tri Combat Base where the South Vietnamese Marine Division is located, which is just less than 10 miles south of where Ripley is at the time. And he's talking to Ripley on the phone and telling him, look, you know, you're going to – we don't have anything to bring up there and reinforce you. You're going to be the one thing that's between us here at Quang Tri Combat Base and the NVA force that's threatening to attack. You need to hold Dong Ha. And, of course, Ripley agrees. It's like, yeah, and I need to – we need to either secure or blow the bridge, because if they get across that, I can't stop them. So – that's kind of the situation on the 1st and 2nd of April. They're trying to pull their forces together. They're trying to hold or at least slow down the NVA movement, preferably if they can get them on the road and make them targets of air and naval gunfire, that would be better. But the one thing they recognize they have to do to stop things or at least make a dent is to hold Dong Ha and hold the bridge. They cannot, the NVA force cannot get south of Dong Ha or the show's over. That's just the way it is.
You know,
that's what he's looking at.
In the audio I just played, he said the order was to die in place. Now,
yeah.
I don't know if anybody, you know, you hear that and everybody goes, oh, yeah, whatever. But when you hear that actually said to you, hey, you're going to die in place there.
Yeah.
That gets your attention like the command fix bayonets. What did he just say? he said fix bayonets. Like, oh, shit. Okay.
Die in place. That was the order that the South Vietnamese Division Commanding General had given to the South Vietnamese Battalion Commander. And Turley will relay that to Ripley. It was like, your counterparts, their order is to die in place. And Ripley and Turley both agree that we're here for the long haul, so yeah, that's my order. I will die in place.
Now, but again, you can't help but know that, you know, and again, as we sand table this, as we war game the offensive and what's next, that the bridge at Dong Ha, that's the piece of infrastructure that will die for. And it's incredible that there wasn't some kind of, whether it be Viet Cong assault or irregular NVA assault on that bridge prior to this happening and in concert with the movement south.
Yeah, I think there's always a, in the back of the NVA's mind or in the back of North Vietnam's mind, is we need to keep intact certain structures. No matter what we do, where we attack, how we fight, there's certain things that have to stay in place. Because ultimately, what you're looking at, the 72 Easter Offensive, is a hybrid version, more of a conventional version of the Tet Offensive a couple years earlier. And it is also the Easter Offensive is the blueprint for what is going to happen in 1975. And I think what a lot of historians fail to do, they fail to recognize, is if you take a look at the Tet Offensive of 68, Easter Offensive of 72, and the Ho Chi Minh Offensive, Ho Chi Minh Campaign of 75, they all look alike. The difference is they grow conventionally with each offensive because we're moving away from the counterinsurgency or the insurgency fight and moving more to the conventional fight. You know, it's Mao's three things. You fight, you know, you bleed them to death through insurgency, and then once you've got them on the ropes, you start conventionalizing, and then you attack their conventional forces with your conventional forces for the final win. So when you look at Tet, Easter, and then Ho Chi campaigns, the North Vietnam will attack in the same locations, just each time it's with more and more conventional forces, more and more artillery, more and more mobile. And it's very, very interesting to see them do it. But each time, they don't blow bridges all the time. Sometimes they do, if they think they're not going to need them. But no, the Yonghe Bridge, they know they're going
to
need.
Right. And so, but to me, it's curious, given their, you know, they had resident irregular forces in the Viet Cong, you know, and look, what we need you to do is we don't need you to hold the bridge. We need you to interdict their efforts to destroy the bridge. And it doesn't, it seems like when you hear him discussing it in the audio clip that he discusses, they're taking fire from conventional forces. But there is what I would consider, there is no special warfare, special operations units, you know, that have infiltrated that are interdicting your ability to blow that bridge, because it is the piece of infrastructure. Because, you know, I can't imagine as we're OPTing this and debating it. So the logisticians say, okay, this is the way it's got to look. This is where it'll be. This is where it has to be. This is the number of units we're going to have on the road. If we don't get that bridge and we're lined up on that road, the Americans see us and they move a carrier and they start rerouting sorties. God help us.
Yeah. I'll tell you this. By the end of 1968, the Viet Cong, the guy in the black pajamas, or maybe the main force Viet Cong element, the guy who's a little more better equipped or trained, he's dead. He's gone. The Tet Offensive has effectively eliminated that insurgency in the South. So 69, 68, 69, 70, more of a conventional war. But, you know, we as the United States are starting to withdraw, and everything comes to kind of a slow halt, because North Vietnam is wanting to see how far the United States will go now that they've started withdrawing the preponderance of their forces, you know, the Nixon Vietnamization campaign. How far are they actually willing to go if we attack? And the Easter Offensive in 72 is that first litmus test. And it's a very conventional attack, and it's done with the idea of, let's see how far the Americans will go. Let's see if they will help defend South Vietnam from a conventional invasion. And if they don't, we'll have all this stuff stacked up on the north side. We'll just steamroll, because we know that the South Vietnamese army will collapse.
Yeah, but this is what I find curious, and it's an interesting discussion. Are the success of this, you know, will largely depend on that bridge? We don't get that bridge, it's not going to happen. Okay, what's plan B? There is no plan B. The plan B is we go by onesies and twosies further west and then head south. What? That's not going to work. You're right. There is no plan B. So to me, it's like, and you know what, that's a great point about the Viet Cong. They're annihilated during Tet. And as is the NVA units, you know, in Tet 1 and 2, you know, this is their first major effort after they've been reconstituted for what, to the tune of 3.5 years.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. And that's, again, you want to talk about the impact of Tet and the opportunity that the Americans, that we had militarily. Certainly when you fold in everything else that went on relative to the Vietnam War, it's a different picture. But militarily, the situation on the ground in Vietnam post-Tet after like about two-thirds of the way through 1968, not the same picture. And again, it takes them 3.5 years to reconstitute to go ahead and do this.
That's why I've never understood why historians and media types will say that the Tet Offensive was the turning point, the downfall of the war. It's like, are you kidding me? The Tet Offensive was a victory for the United States and for South Vietnam. It was not a defeat. You know, nowadays you'll see, like with Iraq and Afghanistan, we are very quick to come out and say things like, well, an attack against the air base in Helmand Province, that is the sign of an enemy that's in the throes, its last throes of defeat, its last throes of life. Well, this was the same thing for the Viet Cong, for the insurgency. The Tet Offensive, when it kicks off, you know, the Viet Cong has taken one hell of a beating at that point, and it doesn't turn out in their favor because of that, and we essentially annihilate what's left of them. And North Vietnam's got to go back and essentially, if it wants the Viet Cong to continue, it's got to repopulate Viet Cong ranks with its own people. And that's going to take time, and it does. You're right. It takes a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, to bring people from the north to the south, infiltrate back into these village areas, and you're going to have conventional North Vietnamese soldiers fighting as guerrillas just to keep the insurgency alive. And that doesn't go well for them either.
You know, but it makes it all the more quizzical. Yeah, you don't hear that one very often. That they wouldn't organize a special unit to specifically capture, like put on South Vietnamese uniforms and capture the Dong Ha Bridge. We're not going to leave that to fiat. We're not going to leave it to chance that they're not going to blow it, because the whole operation rests on this. So to me, it's just again, when you hear him discuss it, you know, a tank main gun round hits the bridge while he's on it. But he's able to make all those trips across that bridge with satchel charges. And we'll get to that in a second. But it's amazing. And you think, like, well, if I'm going to, first of all, I'm not going to the gulag for this, okay? The critical vulnerability in this plan is that bridge. Okay, go, where's Captain Zinni? Get me the Vietnam equivalent of Captain Zinni. Zinni, come here. Right, you're going to the gulag with me if you don't seize this. So I don't care what uniform you put on. I don't care what you do. You seize that bridge, or you interdict their ability to destroy it. Do you understand me?
Mm-hmm.
And Captain Zinni would say, yes, sir, and he'd go do it. And it's just interesting that they wouldn't do that. All right, so proceed. So talk about Colonel Ripley's actions at the bridge that day.
Well, after conversations with Colonel Turley on the phone, the decision is made that, you know, the decision is made quietly amongst the Marines that we're going to have to do something. We're going to have to seize the bridge. We're going to have to blow the bridge. Now, there is a Vietnamese, South Vietnamese general down in Saigon who is saying, no, we're not going to blow the bridge. We need the bridge for a counterattack. In Ripley and Turley's mind, the South Vietnamese military is not in any shape to conduct any kind of a counterattack. You know, just being able to fight off this assault, this offensive, is essentially going to beat them down to parade rest. So Turley says to Ripley, what do you want to do? And Ripley says, I want to blow it up. Turley says to him, John, blow the bridge up. So what Turley does is he asks his Vietnamese counterpart, can you help me get some of the explosives that are here at Quang Tri onto a truck and moved up into place just south of the bridge, while the South Vietnamese Marine Battalion is making their way west to east to the bridge to seize it. And the Vietnamese officer agrees. So they launch a couple trucks from Quang Tri Combat Base just south of Dong Ha, just south of the bridge, and they offload a bunch of explosive materials. You know, all the stuff that he would need, you know, all of your time fuse, your detonators, your blasting caps, your TNT, everything. They offload it just south of the bridge. They take off, and Ripley and the South Vietnamese Marine Battalion show up a couple hours later.
Okay, let me stop you. Yep. Ripley relays in the discussion with Turley who we need permission from to blow the bridge. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and again, that Turley radios down to Saigon to talk to the senior Marine advisor there and then talk to the Vietnamese counterpart. And to blow the bridge is a very, very political, it's a political decision not to as much as it is to. And let me kind of unpack that. The South Vietnamese don't want to be in a position where it looks like they're doing something out of desperation. They want to continue to show that they are in control of the situation, and everything is okay. Blowing the bridge looks like an act of desperation. And then at the same point, they're trying to save face, and by blowing the bridge takes away the opportunity for them to then counterattack. So there's also this bravado where, no, we don't want to blow the bridge because it'll kind of look desperate, but also we don't want to blow the bridge because you know, we want to give the impression that we're going to exact revenge. We're going to conduct a counterattack as soon as we get this area stabilized. So it's political, and it's showing it's face saving. Ripley and Turley at the time, they could really care less about all that. What they see is the tactical situation. If we don't blow this bridge, Quangtri Province is going to get overrun by mech and armor forces in half a heartbeat. And there are a couple hundred Marine advisors that are still in South Vietnam at the time, and probably half of those Marine advisors, officer and enlisted, are up in the Quangtri Province. Those guys are going to become compromised and overrun and killed in half a heartbeat. These are the guys like Walt Boomer and Ray Smith that are up there at that time fighting with Ripley. So you got the political and face saving, and then you've got all the way down to the tactical level of, hey, you know, who do I need to talk to convince that this bridge needs to be blown? So the bottom line is the order comes from Saigon, from the South Vietnamese and American side, saying, no, you do not have permission to blow the bridge. Ripley and Turley decide amongst themselves, it's the only way we're going to survive. It's the only way that South Vietnam, at least the northern half or the northern province, is going to remain under South Vietnamese control. So we have to blow the bridge. There's your tactical decision that has strategic impacts.
Oh, my God. Yeah, what now, Lieutenant? What now?
Yeah, exactly.
What now, Captain? All right, yeah. Here you are. The Corps has told you not to blow it. And you know, Ripley's not funny, but he says, Turley says, look, I got to go to Corps to get that, and they're not going to give it, so blow it.
Yeah.
Right? And so pretty interesting, and decision-making not for the faint of heart. Certainly.
Nope.
And
if you know, if you're worried about your career, that's not the position you want to be in.
But if you're worried about, you know, the other part of this that's interesting as an advisor is you're looking at that situation and you're going and you're saying to yourself, not only am I going to die, right? Smith, Boomer, all these guys that I know that are here, they're going to die too.
Mm-hmm.
And so interesting the impact of your fellow Marines and on that decision.
All right, absolutely.
So you said a couple hours later, Colonel Ripley shows up at the bridge with his battalion.
Yeah, he shows up at the battalion's nestled right inside the town of Dong Ha. And Ripley moves forward with about a platoon size element, maybe a little bit larger. From one of the Vietnamese companies to kind of assess the southern portion of the bridge. He can see NVA forces across the river. He can see the armor and the tanks. They start actually engaging him. Throughout, Ripley will call. He's got a radio on the back. He will call for naval gunfire all over his position and north of the bridge, which is interesting. You don't read much about it, but he, on many occasions, directs naval gunfire well within danger close. That's just a small piece of what he was doing. I mean, everything with the explosives, the blasting cast being out on the bridge, under the bridge, being targeted by both cannon fire from tanks and machine guns and small arms fire, calling in naval gunfire essentially on top of your position. I mean, naval gunfire is impacting, you know, probably 50 yards away, and within that. And these are some pretty big shells that are landing too. So Ripley goes south of the bridge and starts assessing what he would have to do to blow the bridge. He starts doing an inspection of the explosives that have been dropped off, and not in the greatest condition. A lot of decay. A lot of rust, a lot of dirt, grime, everything. So the explosives he has there are, you know, they're not as pristine as the stuff we give the lieutenants when they go out to blow at Charlie demo at the basic school. And Ripley doesn't have an engineer with him, so everything he's about to do, he's going to have to draw from his experiences and his training when he is a ranger at ranger school in his time in recon. But he puts together a plan. And lo and behold, as he's doing that, Colonel Turley's able to get a hold of the South Vietnamese Tank Battalion. I think it's the 20th Tank Battalion that is a couple miles south of Ripley. He gets a hold of the advisors, Major James Smock, U.S. Army, and he asked him, can you go north and assist the Marine battalion that's up there and the Marine advisor? They're going to try to stop the assault across the Dung Ha Bridge. And Smock says, we're on our way. So it almost happens in perfect sequence. The demo shows up, Ripley and the battalion's moving east. The demo gets dropped off, Ripley and the battalion show up, start doing an assessment. Turley's able to get a hold of the 20th Tank Battalion advisor. He agrees to go north and link up with Ripley to assist, provide them with fires, any kind of assistance, evacuate casualties. Ripley and Smock meet along the side of the road, and he says, hey, Jarhead, I hear you're going to blow up a bridge. Let me give you a hand. And away they go.
Tell us about his actions at the bridge.
Okay. So the original assessment that Ripley makes, other than looking at the explosives, he starts to look at, what do I have to do to the bridge and how do I blow it? Because you're going to have to position the explosives in a certain way. You just can't stack them up there and blow it. It won't work. You're dealing with large chunks of concrete, wood, and steel. And each one of those, the explosives is going to react differently with. So, you know, placement, timing, that's all going to play into it. And then Ripley's got the other problem of, how do I get out there to put the explosives in place, in the proper place? So, you know, he's looking at the bridge and doing an assessment, and then he's got to assess how the hell he's going to do that. And then he's got to assess, how am I going to stay alive? Because they're shooting at me on the other side of the riverbank. They can see me, and it's likely they know what I'm doing. Something that doesn't often get much attention, but I think is interesting, is as Ripley is doing this, a South Vietnamese Marine, a sergeant, a squad leader, that's with Ripley, he's part of that kind of escort force that goes up to the bridge with Ripley, has all his Marines get down on the either side of the bridge to provide covering fire for him. This sergeant takes a light anti-armor weapon, moves just to the center of the bridge. There is a lead NVA tank that is starting to make its way up on the bridge. Now, the NVA are not entirely sure that they can move all this armor and mech across the bridge. Now, some of the PT-76s will just float across. They'll
right.
swim across.
Right.
But the armor is going to have to use that bridge. There's a small footbridge just to the left of, if you're looking north, just to the left of the Dung Ha Bridge, there's a small passenger and vehicle footbridge that there's no way the armor is going to be able to get across. So the armor knows we have to take the main bridge. So this first lead tank starts nudging his way up to see, okay, is this bridge going to hold me? When he realizes it's going to hold, he starts making his way across. Well, this South Vietnamese Marine sergeant jumps up right in front of this tank, you know, probably about 25 or so meters away, and hits him. Well, he fires one and misses. I think he fires a second and misses, or it's a flank, grazing shot. The third one right up underneath the turret and jams this tank. So now he can't move his gun, and if he shoots, the trajectory's too high, he's not going to impact anything. So the tank essentially backs down off the bridge and sits right there. So really, while Ripley's assessing, him and Smock are assessing and prepping the explosives, it's this one South Vietnamese Marine sergeant that goes up there and halts the armor advance. And you don't read much about it. It's in a couple books, but it's glossed over. That guy had a set. For him to walk up on that bridge and do that, not only take one, two, but three shots, you know, at a tank like that, that took some cojones.
Yeah, you're not going to get, first of all, you go out into that road, you don't know, if you've been around combat for any length of time, I think it takes maybe 30 to 60 days. You see so many different things, and people killed so many different ways that you realize that, look, whether I come back off this bridge is going to be a crapshoot, right? And again, much like him discussing in his own words, Colonel Ripley, that is, he felt horrible because he knew that he was going to leave his children without a father and the effect on his wife, and he talks about that.
Mm-hmm.
So in these incredible circumstances, these guys step forward and
Colonel Ripley will also say, you know, is like, but after he got through all of that and he realized that, you know, he's no longer worried about saving his own butt. He was like, you just move forward and you do it. So the best thing you can do is just realize that, hey, I'm going to die. And once you've convinced yourself of that, I got nothing to lose.
Do you recall the scene in Band of Brothers when Lieutenant Spears looks at a kid named Blythe and he said, Blythe, you're never going to be able to function as a soldier until you come to grips with the fact that you're already dead?
Exactly.
And Blythe looks at him, and there's so much wisdom in Band of Brothers that I don't know that you can understand if you've never fought.
Yeah.
And once you have, there's certain small things that are sewn into that thing throughout that are pregnant with the experience of going to war for your country. It's an amazing, in my opinion, an absolutely amazing series. If you haven't watched it and you've been to war, you should watch it because there's a million things in there that you will notice differently than had you not had that experience. I think it's awesome.
Absolutely, absolutely. That is critical. That overwhelming feeling that you're going to die once you come to grips with it. Now everything's easy.
Right. I'm not. You know, and it's interesting talking to him. I Musselman will be on, and I'll tell him. So, Mike, survival in combat is more luck or more skill? And he starts laughing. He said it's luck.
Yeah.
He said, you know, you're around so much stuff and stuff's flying everywhere, and why does he get hit and I don't get hit and all the rest of that stuff. He said, Mac, you know it. It's luck. It's easier mentally once you come to that realization, yes?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. And when I've been in combat, I have felt the same way, that at first you've got this, you know, as an officer, as a leader, you're afraid to get your Marines killed. You're afraid to give the wrong decision, the wrong order. And then when you somewhere along the line you start thinking about, holy shit, you know, the order I just gave also could be my own death order. And once you move beyond that and you realize that there's no skill involved here, it's all luck, and if I'm going to die and today's my day, there ain't shit I can do about it anyway. You shed that cloak of fear, and it's just, now you don't go do something stupid like, you know, stand up in the middle of gunfire, like you're looking for the Medal of Honor or something. You're not Stonewall Jackson or anything like that, but you find yourself free of that fear, and your thinking is much clearer because you recognize the inherent risks of what you're doing. But you're in the position, you can't call a timeout, you can't open your eyes and all of a sudden be at home. You're in the situation, make the most of it. Do what you do, use your training, and also understand it's going to take a whole lot of luck, but none of that you can control.
You know, it's interesting. I a year and a half ago, my son left, and, you know, missiles are getting shot in Korea, and all of that, you know. So what do you say to your son as he's going to leave, and you don't know if you'll see him again? And so what do you say to him? And I remember he was with was with Kilo 3-5. And so, you know, if anything happens, they'll certainly be a part of it. And I remember telling him, I said, hey, the only advice I'd give you is don't worry about getting killed. And he just looked at me. Conversations you would hope you'd never have with your son. But, you know, if you do, you're more than willing to. And he looked at me and I said, you can't duck in time. Right, and you're not going to see it coming. Whether you live or die is out of your hands. So just do your best. Don't be afraid, and don't worry about it, because it's out of your hands. Now, I don't know if you, and it's great advice. I don't know that you can understand it till you're there for a little bit of time. But I think you're right. It is certainly comforting to know that, you know, that there's nothing I can do about this.
Yeah.
And you do find peace there. And again, when I saw that, in Band of Brothers, I was like, holy shit, man, that is some incredible combat wisdom right there.
Yeah, it is. From such a young guy, too.
Right.
He realized how quickly those guys grew up.
All right, let's talk about him. He on the bridge and how that whole thing unfolds. So the tank, the lead tank gets stopped, and he's on the south side of the bridge.
Yep, and you know the NVA is trying to figure out. Okay, we think we know what this guy's going to do. They're trying to hold us up to blow the bridge. So some of the tanks and the PT-6s start moving down on the edge of the river, the shoreline there, and Ripley has naval gunfire to come in to shoot on those vehicles and tanks to stop them, at least the PT-76s, from swimming across the river. So he's effectively got the enemy force, not bottled up per se, but held. They're at their limit of advance. They're not going anywhere forward. So Ripley and Smock have assessed not only what they need to do, but how they need to do it. So one thing that's in his way, or actually two obstacles in the way, one is get the explosives up there into the bridge so he can move them into place, and the other is, you know, this fence, this chain link fence that's around the base of the bridge, where the bridge connects to the shoreline. And it's got concertina wire over the top of it. So, you know, Ripley says, hey, there's only one way to go through. We don't have any wire cutters or anything here. You just got to slide through it. And, you know, he jumps up, grabs a hold of the trestles on the bridge and starts doing the hand walk until he gets to the concertina wire. And he kicks his leg up and he pulls himself through. And I can tell you, you know, having met the colonel and talked to the colonel on a number of occasions, I've seen the man in short sleeves and I've seen the man wearing shorts. And he's got more slice scars from the concertina wire slicing his arms and legs than I had ever seen on any person. I mean, in the summertime, when you'd look at Colonel Ripley's arms and legs, those scars would show up as white because it's, you know, it's newer. Yeah, it's just amazing, and it's on his hands, it was on his forearms, all the way up past his elbows, and it was down around his shins and ankles, his calves, his knees, and his thighs, and they're real pencil-thin, like, lines that are whiter. You know, the rest of his skin would tan, but those scars would stay, like, a lighter color, so you could very easily see that he had scars on his arms and legs. So he literally numerous times pulled himself back and forth through that concertina wire, and it was each time it was slicing through his camouflage utilities and cutting his arms and legs. And then, of course, what he was trying to do was get the explosives were inside of the, some were metal, some were wooden crates, you know, the typical crates that you would get, you know, mortar rounds in and the cans that you'd get machine gun rounds in. It was those materials. But they were larger. I mean, these cases were 50, 60 pounds in weight. Smock, Major Smock, would have to lift them up, and he was a much bigger guy than Ripley. He would have to lift them up, and Ripley would then have to pull them, and then, and, you know, this was, of course, after he had slid through the concertina wire, he had to pull them and bring them, angle them, and bring them up so he could position them inside the trestle of the bridge, and then slowly pull those crates out to the center of the bridge, using the trestle almost as a railroad track. So they were fit under, they would fit in nicely, and he'd be able to pull it instead of having to carry the stuff out there.
Now, the whole time he talks about, though, kind of putting satchel charges on his shoulders and hand walking out there. Is that a different phase of it? Or and here's a stupid question. I'm looking at pictures of so if you do a search on John Ripley USMC Dong Ha Bridge, you're gonna find obviously a couple of famous paintings, and you see a picture of the bridge itself, and the picture of the bridge itself, you look at it, and how did he get around the concrete supports that come out of the river bed. So, do you know what I mean? This is stupid kind of like Mac looking at it, going, "How the hell did he do that? How did he get?"
Some of those paintings I don't think are completely accurate, but he's able to get them out as far as the structure will allow him to. And essentially what it allows him to do is get out about 100 feet.
Okay. All right. That
from the riverbank. So pulling the structures out, or I'm sorry, pulling the explosives out, by doing that, he now has filled those areas where he could move. He could have easily moved through. That space is all filled up with explosives now. So to go out there and set the satchel charges and the blasting caps and the deck cord in to do all of, or the timing fuse to do all of that, he now has to make that whole trip doing the hand walk. So to kind of recap, you slide through the concertina wire, you turn around, Smock lifts up these explosive crates to you. You wedge them up on the inside of the bridge trestle, and then you pull them, literally like tug of war, you pull them, those crates, all the way out. You know, they're fit snug into the trestle, but you pull them all the way out about 100 feet. And then Ripley decides, because the different structures or the different materials that make up the bridge, I have to be able to blow the bridge up to get it off of the concrete and wood stanchions. But in addition to that, because the bridge has metal to it, if I just blow it straight up, it's going to fall straight back down. So I have to blow it up, and then I have to get it to twist to snap the metal, or to move the metal left or right to get it to collapse and not land directly back on the stanchions. So he has, what he does is he does like a zigzag pattern with the explosives. That gives him, the explosive will give him the lift and the twist and snapping motion to collapse the bridge instead of it just lifting straight up and then falling straight back down onto the stanchion. Does that make sense?
Well, you know what? You're seeing his time working with special forces and demolitions, because, you know, novices to demolitions would rig it and pack it and then blow it, and the bridge would lift up and it would settle down. But it takes somebody with a little bit of experience that understands the ripping properties and the blasting properties of explosives to understand how we need to twist this steel. And what's even more amazing about it is he's doing this without being fed. You know what I mean? The state of condition that he's in is not a good state. Leave it at that.
And exactly. He's had zero sleep. And I think he's eaten like once in the last 3 days. He's dehydrated. He's mentally and physically exhausted. That's when he gets to the bridge. And then he starts doing all this with the mental stress of knowing that I'm gonna leave my kids and wife behind. I'm gonna die. I'm gonna get all these people killed if I fail, etc. He's got all that churning that he's internalizing at the same time that he's being shot at. He's handling all these very unstable explosives. I mean, what could have been going through his mind? I can't imagine.
Yeah, I can't even.
But for him to have the wherewithal and the situational awareness to still recognize that I can't just pack it and blow it. I've got to situate these explosives in a way that gives me, like you're saying, the lift and the twisting snap motion that's going to effectively bring this bridge down. Let me throw this out there.
I think they used to call that, in our old fitness report system, they used to call that presence of mind.
Yes, absolutely. And you know,
only, and again, I think the caveat to that category was only to be judged in combat.
Yeah.
No shit.
Exactly. That presence of mind was critical. But, you know, let me throw something else out here. When Ripley is moving those explosives in the place, you know, he's up inside the trestle of the bridge, one of the trestles, and it's the one closest to the eastern portion of the bridge, the right side of the bridge as you're looking north. As he's moving it in there, a tank moves into position and is able to fire off a 90-millimeter round, and it hits the exact trestle, maybe feet from Ripley. and almost knocks Ripley into the water. He's able to kind of catch himself and hang on. Now, I'm going to tell you, for the audience out there and anyone, I want you to get inside of a tank or something steel and have someone on the outside take a hammer and smack that tank or wet steel object you're in as hard as they can, you know, inches from your head, and tell me if your head doesn't ring. Now, magnify that by 100. Ripley gets hit. Essentially, the only thing separating him from that 90-millimeter tank round is the steel girder or the steel trestle that he is pulling those explosives through. There's not a doubt in my mind that Ripley was concussed the rest of the day as he's continuing to use presence of mind and move explosives into place, etc. So he's not only mentally exhausted and physically exhausted, dehydrated, hasn't slept or eaten, worried about losing his life, orphaning his kids, etc., or getting all these Marines killed, failing his mission, but he's also now concussed. Incredible. I mean, show me, and that's why Jerry Turley will tell you the single greatest heroic feat in recorded time. There's no doubt. Show me something greater. And I think often historians overlook this. And this might, you know, this could very well be a reason why he doesn't get the Medal of Honor later on, is because I don't think we've ever taken those things into consideration. But that's another story.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that in a few minutes.
Go ahead.
A couple of one is an email question. I just looked up John Ripley, USMC, Dong Ha. There is what looks like to be a picture, not a painting, but an actual picture of somebody with jungle boots on, because you can see the sole of the Vibram boot hanging on the underside of a bridge. Is that an actual image of him?
I don't know. Where did I'd have to be able to see that picture. There's that I know of.
I just found it. I will email it to you here.
Okay.
And you can take a look at it.
That I know of, there are no photographs or footage, anything detailing or showing him conducting his actions. There is video footage taken by CBS News that's on the scene during the offensive when Ripley is at the village getting ready to move east. But that photographer or that the cameraman and the newsman, they disappear to go south to cover something else when Ripley moves to the bridge. When they hear about him blowing the bridge, they move back north, but it's already over.
I was going to say, it's called covering your ass. That's what they went to cover. Like, hey, this shit's going to be out of control. We probably don't want to be where these guys are going. Interesting. Again, my guest, we're talking about Legends of the Marine Corps, and certainly John Ripley is that. And we're talking about his career, his exploits at the Dong Ha Bridge. Tell us the rest of the story.
Yeah. Okay, so I just got your picture. Yeah, so that picture is the diorama that's up at the Naval Academy. So that's not actually an image. That's like a, not claymation, but a diorama that was put together. It's up in, it's the main hall there at the Naval Academy, because I'm not an Academy graduate. I can't tell you what a hall it is, but, it's there right when you go to the front entrance. It's near, I think it's got all the names of those who have perished in combat that went to the Academy, and it's got this diorama there of Ripley, moving. But you can see those trestles in that picture. That's where he's up inside pulling the explosives. And again, when he sets those explosives in place, he now has to go back out there with the satchel charges to put all the time fuse and the blasting caps in. And the only way for him to do that now is to hand walk. And that's what he does. He goes and he spends the next couple hours doing this dramatic hand walk. Every now and then, slowly, you know, throwing his legs up into the trestle, stopping, taking a breath or two, you know, rigging up the time fuse and the blasting caps setting everything in place, jumping down, hand walking over to the next one, et cetera. So, yeah, it's a pretty daunting task when you're tired, hungry, exhausted, dehydrated, and concussed.
And you know, the other thing that it is a pretty amazing display of what you're capable of under those circumstances when your body's gushing adrenaline.
That it
all goes out the window, and you know, and you've heard people describe these moments of clarity even in the most dire circumstances where, no, it was crystal clear to me. It was crystal clear to me what needed to happen. And you're like, how in God's name? I mean, how in the course of human beings could this be? And nonetheless, you know, it certainly was. They blow the bridge, yes? Is there any, talk about blowing the bridge itself, physically doing it.
So another piece to consider is once Ripley goes out and sets the blasting caps in place, what he doesn't have is he doesn't have the crimpers to lock the time fuse into the blasting cap.
Yeah.
And what he determines is, well, in order for the timing fuse to sit in the blasting cap, which will then get connected to the explosives, that time fuse gives him the time, once he pulls the igniter on the time fuse and it sets the clock, he calculates that he needs about 15 minutes to hand walk back, get on the other side of the bridge, and beat feet before the bridge blows. So he does essentially a trick that they taught him in Ranger school where he stretches his arm out as far as it'll go, and each arm length is several minutes of time fuse.
Yeah.
And he times that by three, and so he gets just enough fuse. He locks that into the blasting cap and then connects it to the explosives. But he doesn't have the time fuse properly set within the blasting cap. So he does another technique that taught in Ranger school, kind of like off the cuff, and it's called jawboning. And what you have to do is take the blasting cap, and you have to put it in your mouth, almost down your throat, and you bite down with your teeth to set the time fuse in place and essentially crimp. The problem with that is there are explosives at the end. And if he crimps too close to the explosives, he could ignite it and essentially blow his head off.
So for those of you who aren't familiar with it, so a blasting cap is a cylindrical device, maybe about 3 inches long, and it's got an explosive in probably 2/3 of it, and there's an opening. This time fuse fits into the cap, and then you have to crimp it to make sure everything's tight and nothing's moving. If you don't crimp it, and during the course of movement or another tank round hitting the bridge, and it pulls out, nothing's going boom. The time fuse, as Ed was saying, it burns at a certain rate. So if you cut 4 feet of it, 4 feet translates to X number of minutes. So this all kind of works together. But there's got to be certain things that happened, and jawboning. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
Well, I hope this works.
So you know, when Ripley's doing this, he's doing it in front of Smock because he does the hand walk back, and he tells Smock, "Look, we don't have any crimpers. I got to do this jawboning technique." So Smock is standing there with him, handing him the stuff, and is like, "Man, you are one stupid Marine. I can't believe I'm watching you do this." Ripley does it 5 times, not once, not twice. 5 times, and then gets back up on the trestles and hand walks back out there to put these blasting caps in place. So now, and then of course, this is the other thing. He doesn't have an igniter that will work. Now remember I told you the demo, the explosives that the South Vietnam Marine drops off at the base of the bridge, it's old. It's practically dunnage. It's grade 3. You know, in the Marine Corps, we would toss that stuff out. But it's all they have. There's no good operating igniter. And what that igniter is you pull that, they take that time fuse, the end that's not inside the blasting cap, and you insert it into this little tube, and it's got a pulley. and you yank that thing really hard, it creates a spark and it sets the time fuse off, which is like setting the clock. So it starts counting down. Well, the time or the igniter won't work. So Ripley actually sets the time fuse by striking a match. He uses just a regular match, lights it, and then lights the time fuse and it starts smoking, and then he hand walks back. That takes another set of cojones, because that stuff is very unstable, it's unpredictable, and an igniter is going to ignite a certain level of heat to ignite that time fuse. A match might have a much greater level of heat, temperature, and it may do something completely erratic to that time fuse. So you don't know what you're going to get when you light that thing off with a set of matches. But that's all he's got to set the time fuse off. So he uses matches, he uses the jawboning technique, does a hand-walking routine, and then he comes back to Smock and he says, like, okay, I think we're ready to go.
Hello. Yeah, let's do this. Like, really?
Let's roll.
Let's roll. Do you not have anything else you want to do out there?
Well, funny you ask that, because it's so comical. And when you talk to, you know, God bless him, may he rest in peace, but when you talk to Captain or Colonel Ripley about this, he was like, Smock looked at me like I was a complete idiot. But every time Ripley came back, there was some new reason why Ripley had to go out on the bridge. And Smock was just like, you know, you're killing me, Marine. So Ripley gets back from doing, you know, setting the blasting caps and the time fuse in place. When he gets back, Smock has come across blasting caps. So they're electrical blasting caps. So Ripley says, okay, if this time fuse doesn't work, we need another way to blast the bridge, to set the explosives off. And he's got these electrical blasting caps with the wire and everything. So Ripley says, I got to go back out there and put this in because we need a secondary means to blow it.
Okay, let me ask you a question. So the one detonation, is that detonation going to set off the other charges? Do they have them daisy-chained in some way, shape, or form?
Yeah, he's got them daisy-chained. So he's got blasting caps stuck into different crates of explosives.
Right.
And then he's going to get he wants to get a sympathetic sympathetic detonation, from the five or six that he's going to set off.
Okay.
So he's going to get that combination of both. But in addition to that, he's really hoping that the time fuse is going to work with the blasting cap. But if it doesn't, he now has a backup, an electrical source. So he goes back out there and he sets this electrical source in. You know, does the whole routine all over again, setting them into place. And then he hand walks back, and he takes the wires that are connected to the electrical caps. And off on the side of the bridge, there's a Jeep that's been destroyed. They pull the battery out of the Jeep. They set it up on top, and Ripley takes the wire, the rubber coating off of the wire, starts sparking them together. And, you know, by this point, Ripley believes the bridge should have blown. I don't think that the time fuse was good. It may have been, again, grade 3. It's unstable. Maybe it went out. I don't know. But it's not working. Maybe my jawboning technique didn't work. Whatever the case is, the bridge isn't blowing it. Maybe I put more than 15 minutes of time fuse on there, but the bottom line is it should have blown by now. So Ripley's got this electrical wire, and he starts touching off the wires to the Jeep trying to get an electrical charge. Well, the wire he's using is also rusted and corroded. So he's thinking to himself, you know, God bless, there's nothing more I can do. You know, time fuse isn't working. I'll give it a couple more minutes. Now I'm using this battery. Maybe the battery doesn't have enough juice. I don't know what the hell is going on. The next thing you know, boom, the bridge goes off. The explosives go off. And Ripley's thrown to the ground, and he says he looks up in the air, and he can see wood, steel, and concrete flying all over the place. And he realizes, well, I don't know what happened, but one of those things finally took hold and worked. And that's it. The bridge, he blows out the southernmost portion of the bridge. It's about 100 feet in length. and it does exactly what he needs it to do. It blows straight up, and it has a twisting motion that snaps the steel and pushes it to the left, and the bridge collapses instead of falling right back down on the concrete girders or structures. And the bridge is effectively impassable. The armor at that point, the mech forces, enemy forces start backing up and start heading west to try a different route to go across. And at that point, Ripley gets on the phone and starts calling for naval gunfire because now they're mobile and moving. They're exposed. It was like, we've got them in the open. Let's hit them. Naval gunfire starts pounding them. So he stops the assault once and for all.
You know, it's an incredible story. I mean, when you listen to the whole thing, the story is almost worthy of fiction in terms of, okay, we want to make an action movie, but can we just dial this back a little bit and get it to something that's plausible? And yeah. and you hear that. So the next question that begs to be answered is, how does John Ripley not receive the Congressional Medal of Honor? And let me just, in talking to different people before I brought you on, Ed, I've heard different reasons for that. One is eyewitness statements. Two, and I want you to talk about the totality of it because, Colonel Turley didn't think he was going to live through it, so he wanted to expedite the process. Lack of eyewitness statements, but the Marine Corps has reviewed it twice, and it hasn't left the Marine Corps with a recommendation to upgrade. So can you explain to us all of this? Because when you read this, and again, there's nothing in Colonel's Rip, I mean, talk about geeky, squeaky, clean, you know, devout, husband, father, Christian, you're not going to find more devout, more squeaky than John Ripley. And so integrity above reproach, yet it somehow leaves you squinting like, I don't understand something. So can you explain, explain what to the rest of us is not understandable.
Okay. There's always an argument of, you know, how long should it take for a person to receive an award for a heroic action?
Okay.
I mean, God forbid, today we have computers, we can communicate and send information in a half a heartbeat, but yet it still takes 2 years for a Marine to receive a Silver Star, and it's unsaid. Well, during Vietnam, we had in many ways the same problem. If you were a Marine, your actions awarded a Bronze Star with V, you could get that Bronze Star with V in a span of maybe a month or so because it was signed off by the commanding general there in Vietnam. A Silver Star would have to go back to headquarters Marine Corps, but usually it took several months for that to come back. Something the likes of a Navy Cross would probably take a good year or so, and the Medal of Honor a couple years. Well, knowing that, the Secretary of the Navy at the time was Secretary John Warner, he himself a former Marine. Warner creates what they would call the fast action request. And it is an award process where if a senior commander on the scene witnesses or has great knowledge of a heroic act, he gets all the details, he types it up in message format, and it gets sent directly to the Secretary of the Navy's staff for adjudication immediately. And this is for Navy Cross and potential Medal of Honor. If it's Medal of Honor, it's going to take a little bit longer, but the Navy Cross action, and they lower it down to Silver Star as well. The fast action request should take a matter of weeks to get before the Secretary of the Navy for him to make the determination. Does it need to go higher? Does it not need to go higher, et cetera? So this act, blowing up of the bridge at Dong Ha, occurs. Colonel Turley's got a couple of things on his mind. The first thing is John Ripley's not going to survive. If he blows the bridge up, he's likely to blow himself up. If he even gets to the point where he can blow the bridge up, he's probably going to get shot and killed beforehand. If he doesn't blow it up and they come steamrolling across, he's going to get captured or killed. And knowing John Ripley, he's not going to get captured. He's going down fighting. So Turley says to himself, whether it's today or in the coming weeks, John Ripley and I and many others are not going to survive this offensive. The numbers are too great. The political pressures that we're not going to reinforce. We'll use air and naval gunfire, but this thing is not going to go well for all of us. So he wants to recognize Ripley after he blows the bridge up successfully. He wants to recognize him as quickly as he can. So within the next couple of days, he launches off a fast action request to the Secretary of Navy's office, bypasses the Commandant and Headquarters of Marine Corps, but they are courtesy copied on it. And the Secretary of Navy approves the award as a Navy Cross. And it's with the understanding that the offensive is still ongoing and the likelihood of survival is limited. Even the Secretary of Navy wants to make sure that John Ripley is at least recognized for this action. So he approves the Navy Cross. Weeks later, Ripley, as the offensive continues, because remember, he blows the bridge up and those forces move west. They go into Laos and they come around and they attack through a different portion of South Vietnam. So Ripley will stay there and defend against the offensive for several more weeks until he's shot in the hip, and he manages to recover and continue fighting, but eventually he's evacuated from country, gets back to the States, and in the fall he's awarded the Navy Cross by Senator Warner. Now, why doesn't he get the Medal of Honor? Okay, there's a bunch of different things out there. The first one is, well, there was only one American eyewitness to the action, and that was Major James Smock. That is what is believed for years, but that's not the case. There is no specific requirement out there that states that it has to be witnessed by two or more Americans. That, I think, is a judgment, but it's also a misnomer. There is no requirement to have two witnesses or more. And for years, that is used as, well, that's the reason why he didn't get it. And trust me, you could have talked to Colonel Ripley himself and asked him why you get the Medal of Honor, and he would tell you, I don't know. I really don't care, but I don't know. You talk to his family and ask them, and they'll tell you, we don't know. He just didn't get the Medal of Honor. But I can tell you that it's not because there was only one witness. In fact, the battalion commander of the South Vietnamese Marine Battalion that Ripley's with, he later becomes an American citizen. And with all that becomes the rights and privileges of being an American, i.e. an eyewitness to a heroic event. He writes a statement, and the attempt to upgrade it still gets turned down. So the two witness thing is a non-player.
Okay.
It's not even a requirement.
Okay.
Going beyond that, when Turley submits the award, he's looking at it as, at a minimum, this is a Navy Cross. But I honestly think that when the Secretary of the Navy staff sees this and they understand what went on, they will hold this and push for a Medal of Honor. Well, for whatever reason, Warner didn't do that. And we think the reason why Secretary Warner didn't is because he himself thought that this is incredible, and the way the reports we're getting about the offensive, you know, if we push for a Medal of Honor, it's likely that Ripley will be dead by the time he receives it. So let's go through with the wishes and award him, bestow something on him as quickly as we can. So for whatever reason, they don't go to the level of Medal of Honor. In addition, for it to be the Medal of Honor, it requires the service chiefs, i.e. the Marine Commandant, to get involved. And I can be honest with you, if you take a look at the message traffic, Turley sends this message off, I want to say it's the 5th of May or the 2nd of May. So it's a full month after Ripley's actions because he's in the fight day on, stay on.
Right. And you don't tend to write awards when you're trying to save a country.
Exactly. And when Turley talks to Headquarters Marine Corps during the time and tells them, look, this is an incredible act, but at my level, the only thing I can do is recommend the Navy Cross. It's got to go. Someone higher than me has to push Medal of Honor.
But
Headquarters Marine Corps is so not in the know at the time. They're just relying on what Turley is telling them, and then Turley is in and out of the fight, that it just becomes more realistic to go Navy Cross, Navy Cross. This is easily Navy Cross. If we go Medal of Honor, it might be 2 years from now. He's probably going to be dead, etc. So Ripley survives. He gets the Navy Cross. But here is something that I find incredibly interesting, and you all have to bear with me because you've heard the stories. Now, I have read the official fast action request that went from Turley and was sent directly to the SecNav's office, bypassing the commandant, etc. Nowhere in there does Turley ever mention that Ripley uses the jawboning technique to set the time fuse into the blasting caps. Nowhere does he mention going back out to set those blasting caps in place. Nowhere does he mention going back out to put the electrical blasting or the electrical cord in place. None of that's mentioned. And the reason why is because it is not known to Colonel Turley at the time that Ripley did those things. The only thing Ripley ever told Turley was, I had to do X, Y, and Z to get the explosives in place and blow them up. He didn't get into the nitty-gritty details of how he did all that stuff, because Ripley himself was in the fight day on, stay on. And at the time, Turley didn't care. He just knew that, hey, the bridge is blown up. I'm going to write John up for an award. He blew the bridge up, and that's all I need to know. But the nitty-gritty details, Ripley's not the kind of guy who's going to run around saying, yeah, I did the jawboning technique 5 times and hand-walked back out there 5 more times and then went back out there 5 additional times. Ripley's not that kind of guy.
Right.
So he never relays those details to Turley, so Turley never puts him in the fast action request. When he sends it to the Secretary of the Navy, it's got essentially bare bones, which was enough to get him the Navy Cross. Turley is of the mind, and so am I as a historian. And I am not showing favoritism towards Colonel Ripley or Ripley family. I'm just using a historical mind here. Had Turley known those specific details, he would have surely added them in there. And had the Secretary of the Navy known those specific nitty-gritty details, it would have sent a flag to anybody saying Medal of Honor, Medal of Honor. Well, it wasn't until several years later, and when I mean several years, about 1975, that Turley learned through somebody else what Ripley had done to get all those explosives set up. The jawboning, going back out with the electrical caps, the whole 9 yards. Turley then starts petitioning through Marine Corps channels, we need to rethink this award, because John Ripley did a whole lot more than just set explosives and blow a bridge. I mean, he put his life at risk by doing these different techniques. And it highlighted the extent of the danger that he put himself in to accomplish the mission. And I don't know why it didn't go anywhere in the 70s or the 80s, but there just wasn't an appetite. I think it was the hangover of Vietnam. I think it was the war's over. We've awarded medals. We don't need to keep bringing this stuff back up. And I think maybe Colonel Ripley was the victim of, let's just put Vietnam behind us and move on.
And again, for people that weren't on active duty then, we were, for instance, I was an instructor at the basic school in IOC from 1989 to 1992. Quantico is a miserable place. Whoever sited that base did an awesome job. It is cold and wet and nasty in the winter. It is humid, filled with bugs, jungle-like vegetation, a million streams and fingers, and navigation is a nightmare there. If you can navigate in Quantico, you can navigate anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hot and disgusting in the summer, and you're out in that humidity under that. During that period of time, we wore woodland utilities made for the plains of Germany, and we wore some kind of synthetic kind of leather boot. Your feet stayed wet all the time, right? Your utilities were soaking wet and heavy all the time. And we would see Vietnam-era uniforms, because there were some guys still around. I'll tell you what. This is the era when I'm a lieutenant. there was a, you know, they still had their Vietnam era uniforms, and you'd see those guys wear some of the camouflage patterns, and you'd say, what's that? I go back to the instructor, most of that stuff's gone, and you can't wear a bush cover, you can't wear, the best boot ever made, was the jungle boot. You couldn't wear it. It had a the sole was kind of a spiked sole, and you could get up mud hills with it. And so what we took to is we'd buy jungle boots and we'd dye the green black, so hopefully nobody could tell, and we'd wear them because they simply dried your feet out and you weren't as miserable. But the Marine Corps was so averse to Vietnam, you couldn't, and the subject of bush covers would come up. They'd be like, no. No, we don't wear that. That's not a. Those were the cosmetics of the uniform, for God's sakes. And we simply. That's how averse to Vietnam the DOD was.
We wanted it all behind us.
Right.
And unfortunately, I think Ripley is a victim of that and a product of it. But, you know, when I bring up these details, you know, the jawboning and repeatedly going back out there, not just to set explosives, but to set the time fuse and the electrical caps in. You know, these are all stories that you and I and many of our listeners have heard about over the years and have taken it as just, yeah, you know, that was fact. Everybody knows that. In all actuality, those details were not known to anybody until 1975. And, you know, so we've taken for granted when we've all sat around and said, anyone hear the story about Ripley blowing up the bridge? Yeah, he put blasting caps in his mouth and bit down on him. Well, and we all say, wow, man, what do you got to do to get the Medal of Honor? Well, I'm here to tell you, those details were not part of the original package getting him the Navy Cross.
Okay.
And Jerry Turley will spend all the way up until this past year continuing to talk to people within the political spectrum, congressmen, you know, senators and representatives. He will talk to Marine general officers. He will try to explain this. He has tried to explain this to the point where two different occasions the Marine Corps has opened the Ripley case to reevaluate. And for whatever reason, I'm not sure what it is, it keeps getting deduced down to his actions merit the Navy Cross and not the Medal of Honor. And
Will you have a letter from General who?
General Jones.
General Jones. Would you share the letter? This is a letter that Jones wrote to who?
General Jones sent this to Colonel Turley. General Turley, let me see, after the board in 2003-2004, looked at the Ripley Award,
and
they had a panel of a handful of retired Marine and Marine general officers, retired admirals, Navy admirals, who they themselves had either received the Medal of Honor or had written someone up in their command for the Medal of Honor, and that person received it.
Okay.
And it's a letter from General Jones to Colonel Turley stating that we've reviewed all of the updated information, and it's the unanimous decision of the board that the information you've provided merely highlights certain actions he's taken, but does not show anything beyond the criteria required to receive the Medal of Honor. And it doesn't go any further than that. It just then talks about how Colonel Ripley is a hero to many,
right,
will always be part of our institution. His actions are, you know, unthinkable and remarkable, but do not raise to the level of the Medal of Honor. And I have the highest respect for General Jones, having met him on a number of occasions and having served in uniform when he was commandant, and you have to respect the man's decision. But at the same time, as a historian, I look back and I say to myself, now, I think what is happening here is everyone is looking back over the years and hearing the story of what Ripley accomplished at Dong Ha, and in their mind is already planted the seed that he bit down on the blasting caps and went out on the bridge multiple times. That's already planted. So when it comes up as a new fact, it's very hard for others to divorce themselves from those details and just look at what the fast action request originally stated. And if you can divorce yourself from those two different sets of details and then clump in the other details, you would then say, oh, well, the Secretary of the Navy was not fully in the know of what Ripley did at the time. And had he had these other details, it is very likely that he would have gone for the Medal of Honor. Now, I'll tell you this. I also have a letter of support from the Secretary of the Navy, who later became Senator John Warner of Virginia, who in his retired years, during the time that Colonel Turley was trying to get the award updated, wrote a letter of support for the action, stating, you know, I agree that some of these new details have come to light, should be considered. I fully endorse the upgrade of Medal of Honor. But the panel that the Commandant of the Marine Corps has put together in the past has not seen it that way. And as a historian, I don't have access to those records. I don't know what conversations occurred. All I know is that the panel, according to General Jones in a letter, voted unanimously not for him not to be reconsidered for the Medal of Honor. And that's where it sits. I know Colonel Turley is in touch with congressmen to this day, and I know there is a very low-level investigation or inquiry into whether or not we should consider once again Colonel Ripley for the Medal of Honor.
So hold on. So General Jones, when he was commandant, some kind of board of inquiry was convened. When was the second one convened?
Let me try to open up these files. So there was a review in the late 80s. I want to say it was 87 or 88 time frame. They looked at opening the case up, and it didn't go anywhere.
Okay.
And then again, it happens in 2003, 2004. Now, I don't have any information on the 1987 attempt other than that it was started by the, it's not the Commandant of Midshipmen, but the senior billet at the Naval Academy. It's a Navy Admiral. When Colonel Ripley would serve at the Naval Academy in the 80s, the Admiral had known him well and thought highly of him and had done the same thing that most Marines do. He'd ask the question, how did you not receive the Medal of Honor? Why has this never been looked into? And Colonel Ripley told him, I don't know, really don't care, sir. I'm not worried about medals. I did what I was supposed to do. And this Navy Admiral sends a letter up the chain stating that I think we need to reconsider this. It goes so far and gets shut down. And I don't have any details to that other than what I've just conveyed to you. But what I also have is the historical record here in 2003, 2004, when General Jones says, let's look at this in detail again. He puts together a board. That board is made of general officers, Fred McCorkle, retired Marine three-star general, four-star general. Walt Boomer is on that board. Colonel Turley himself is on there. General Jim Joy, who was an advisor in the vicinity of Dong Ha. Retired General Bill Weiss, who he himself received the Navy Cross as battalion commander at Dido, as battalion commander at 2-4 in 1968. He wrote two of his company commanders up, Jim Livingston and Jay Vargas, for the Medal of Honor. They both received it.
Right.
General Don Gardner, a Marine general and Medal of Honor recipient, Wes Fox, was also on that board. And then there were a couple of Navy admirals. And, you know, I don't know if this was the final board that voted in favor of awarding, but I know it was a board that looked into the details. The board that voted and recommended unanimously to General Jones that Ripley not receive the award, or he not reopen the case, I don't know who was on that board. And I don't know where those records would be.
Well, I'll tell you what, the names, talk about pantheon of heroes. when you begin to drop those names in terms of guys who sat on that was General Jones's board, right?
I think he did. I think General Jones put that board together, and then he selected some of them to be voting members.
Wow.
But I'm looking at this, and I have my date slightly off. So it's 2002 when they do that review, not 2003 or 4.
Okay.
What I was looking at for the 2003 or 4 was a rebuttal. But the 2002 letter from General Jones, then the Commandant to Colonel Turley, not retired, simply states, and I'll quote here, I'm writing to follow up to you on the award recommendation you submitted on Colonel Ripley's behalf in September. Let me first express my thanks for extraordinary care and attention with which you prepared your request. I received the package in detail. I reviewed the package in detail and concluded that there was no new evidence submitted that would allow me to revisit the original board's decision. There were several factors that weighed in on my decision, and I would like to share them briefly. I'm continuing to quote. In the adjudication of historic awards issues, I am hesitant to reverse a decision made by those who had the benefit of context, i.e., the level of award was consistent with similar awards present during that time. End quote. And essentially what he's saying here is, in the context, what Ripley did compared to others who received the Medal of Honor during that same time period. Were they the same? Were they equal? Was he as much in danger, his life at risk, etc.? So back to quoting in the letter, I am willing to consider new and relevant information that was unavailable at the time an award recommendation was originally considered. In Colonel Ripley's case, this element is not present as the basic facts outlined in the original award nomination are unchanged. There is tremendous detail added to the original submission, but there is no significant new information on which to pursue an upgrade. As a historian, this is where I disagree with the Commandant. Because as I told you, if you look at the fast action request, which is the original award request, there is no mention of jawboning technique or Ripley going out repeatedly to reset blasting caps, electrical caps, and etc. That, in fact, is new information. And unfortunately, what I think General Jones is getting caught up in is, years ago and all throughout his career after Vietnam, everyone has known these facts of Ripley jawboning, but in all actuality, people are getting that mixed up with what was actually reported. And that's where I think the Commandant is missing it here. That is new information. He says it's tremendous detail added to the original submission, but it is not new significant information. I disagree. Knowing that someone five times put an electrical or put an explosive blasting cap down his throat and crimped, threatening to blow his head off five different times, that being added years later to an award nomination is new information. That doesn't add tremendous detail. That is new information. But I am a historian, and that's how I read that. Back to this letter, General Jones will go on to just say, Jerry, I want to express once more my thanks to you for this concern. I look forward to our continued association and friendship. I hope you will not hesitate to get in touch with me if you have any questions or need additional information. Semper Fi, Jim Jones, General U.S. Marine Corps, Commandant of the Marine Corps. So that's the letter. There's a little more information in there, but nothing relevant to this conversation. So the hang up with Ripley with the attempts to upgrade, to me, boiled down to, does anyone have new and relevant information that doesn't just highlight what he had already done, but changes the facts or adds to the facts? And I think that becomes very subjective. In my opinion, the information that Turley has presented is new. And I think it not only is not only tremendous detail, but it heightens the level of danger that Ripley put himself in. I'll add that some people have, and this is conjecture, some historians have added that Ripley knew that there was the possibility that he would die blowing up the bridge, and he had the option of not blowing it up, but he went with the option of doing it anyway. In other words, there was a way around of risk, way around risking his life, and he chose, you know, the direction of risking his life. To me, that smacks of heroism above and beyond. But Ripley very well had another choice, and that was just to leave the bridge in place and defend from the south side. So some historians believe Ripley was not put in a position where he had no other choice, that he did have a choice. And how they come to that being less than someone who had no choice, I don't know. If, I mean, any human being, if they have a choice of saving their own skin, will probably choose to save the option to save their own skin. Ripley went above and beyond, and he did it multiple times. And again, that's subjective in nature. So I don't know. I don't know why, other than this information here, I as a historian, I'm as, you know, in Marine Corps terminology, I'm as befuckled as anybody else.
I've never even heard that term.
Have you never heard befuckled?
No.
Oh, man, that goes right up there with, well, I won't say the other ones.
Fucking leaveable. There's a whole vocabulary out there, folks.
Well, my favorite is, my favorite is who fat or a rat fucked the MREs, but befuckled is another good one.
That's a tradition, okay? That is, yeah, a tradition that goes back to sea rats or whatever ate before that. Whoever gets their first taking what they want, exactly. Unbelievable. The yeah. Let's talk the balance of his career and life. He goes on to become battalion commander at 1-2. He's honored by the United States Army Rangers because he's Colonel Ripley's a stud. He's the regimental commander of 2nd Marines when you know, an unfortunate but infamous incident happens at 29 Palms. That is the death of Corporal Jason Rother. And he's the exercise commander when a subordinate unit loses track of a Marine, and ultimately Rother dies. And then he continues on in the Marine Corps, a series of MOI assignments, and then he retires. Any thoughts on the balance of his career?
Yeah, you know, he had, he commanded at every level from platoon all the way up to the regiment, and he did it with distinction. And I think when you look back his time as a regimental commander, drove his Marines hard, drove his regiment hard. You'll see, you know, a number of papers written by students that attend the Marine Corps Command and Staff College in the late 80s, early 90s, that will talk about the changing nature of the Marine Corps and how the Marine Corps is getting soft. We're not training hard. We're not training properly. We're not preparing for combat properly. And you know, and you know, Mac, as an instructor at the basic school in IOC, as well as I do, is, you know, the way you take care of your Marines is hard, realistic training, because you will save their asses in combat. That's how you take care of Marines.
That's it.
And Ripley was of that school.
Let me read you 6 bullets that his son. Were you at his funeral?
I did not. I was actually overseas, stationed in Vietnam doing a missing in action recovery mission.
What?
When the colonel died.
Holy
yeah.
Shit! Well, you're gonna get to come back on and talk about that, because
yeah, sure, no problem.
I find that stuff. Let me see. I have to uphold my father's style of leadership was summed up on a card he gave me when commissioned. A Marine leader must have 1, the spirit of the attack, march to the sound of the guns. 2, boldness. You are part of the finest fighting force in the world. Act like it. 3, a receptiveness for risk-taking. Risk comes with the job. If you are not comfortable operating with risk, then you need to get into a new line of work. 4, endurance, mental and physical. Mental is far more important than physical. 5, decisiveness. Make a decision, Lieutenant! And 6, a sense of mission, a sense of duty. Mission first, Marines always. So I think when you talk about two of those points, boldness, right? Act like it. 2, taking risk, right? Risk comes with the job. If you're not comfortable operating with risk, then you need to to get into a new line of work. And I'll offer one more lesson that he talks about is that there were only two seats on the John Ripley train, on it or under it. Okay.
Absolutely.
So you can distill that into a guy. And again, I read another little blurb from this, and that was always take the more difficult route. You will arrive there in one piece, and you will keep your Marines alive. So when you put that together, you're talking about a man who's physically hard, who's mentally hard, who understands the rigors of combat, and believes that we ought to train that way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And again, you will see in papers written by officers attending the Command and Staff College in the late 80s, 90s, they will talk about this changing mentality in the Marine Corps and how we're not developing Marines to be mentally and physically tough, and how training is getting softer in order to spare the Corps, spare injuries. You know, we're making Marines softer. And they will cite their time in the regiment that Ripley commanded, 2nd Marines down at Lejeune. And they will say, here's a guy who continued to push Marines mentally to the mental and physical limits because he knows what awaits them out there. And that's not to say that the other regimental commanders weren't, but it was, you know, to these majors, you know, that had just got finished serving as company commanders in Ripley's regiment, or maybe as lieutenants in the regiment, they're saying that this guy was still pushing us hard and for a reason, and the Marine Corps needs to learn from this. And, you know, I think Ripley was at a time the Marine Corps was changing, and we were becoming more of a zero defect. You know, you make one mistake or something happens in your command, and you know, we're going to move you on in your career. You know, because of the Rother incident, I don't want to speculate did that affect his career. I don't know. I don't know for sure. I just don't know. But there was a time, and it happened in the late 80s, early 90s, where the Marine Corps started to change. And you see today, battalion commanders, squadron commanders getting relieved constantly for providing a hostile command climate, or you know, not providing equal opportunity. You can get relieved in a heartbeat now as a battalion or a regimental commander, squadron group commander, for things way, way less. These squadron and commanders are getting relieved today for things that would never leave the local commander's office or his purview. And they're going all the way up to the commandant of the Marine Corps today. If Ripley had an incident where a Marine didn't feel like he was being given an equal opportunity, in Ripley's day as a regimental commander, he just said, shut the hell up, Marine. You're getting paid. You're a Marine. You wear the uniform. Move on. Get ready for combat. Today, goes to the commandant of the Marine Corps, and a commander gets relieved for not providing equal opportunity. And I think Ripley was growing up as a colonel, you know, moving towards general at a time when the Marine Corps was changing and the mentality was changing. And he was part of the old guard. And, you know, at that point, after he's a regimental commander, he would move on to be the Marine officer instructor, or I'm sorry, the professor of naval science at Oregon and then at VMI.
And I'll just say this. When you get sideways in the Marine Corps, it depends – like, who is there, what they think of you, mm-hmm. and because as you go through the Marine Corps, there's different tribes in the Marine Corps that you perform your way into. And, you know, if you don't penetrate, and there's a group of, I will tell you, as you go through the Marine Corps, there's a group of people that are operators. From regimental command, you go to PP&O, you go to, you know, those assignments, right? You go back to the MEF, you go, get back to the division, chief of staff. There's a whole series of routes that take you in and out of command billets, key operational, you know, billets that keep you into the flow of the Marine Corps towards general officer rank. And it seems to me pretty obvious that Colonel Ripley doesn't go down that path. And somebody makes those decisions about those assignments. And again, whether it's a combination of the Rother incident and his hardness or whatever, or just a clash of personalities, it is interesting given his valor that, that he does kind of his career kind of operationally ends where it ends. But certainly in no way, shape, or form diminishes his service to the nation. But sometimes it's simply a clash of personalities. And but it is a part of his record, and so I wanted to mention it.
Yeah, and there are gentlemen like Colonel Ripley that will have the Navy Cross Medal of Honor, and they won't move beyond the rank of colonel. They won't become a general. And the immediate reaction is, well, there has to be something in their past that stopped them. That's not necessarily the case. To be a general, this is me, this is Ed speaking. I don't know that as a Marine I would want a General Ripley, because I want Warfighter Ripley. I would rather see that guy commanding fleet operational units, commanding infantry regiments and stuff like that. I don't want to see him mixing up in the Pentagon, getting paper cuts, having to deal with senators and representatives, having to deal with politicians and the other being joint and making sure that he's getting his purple credential. None of that stuff matters. I don't want to see John Ripley.
I never met the man, but I have a sense that would not have gone well.
No, it wouldn't have. It wouldn't have. And I don't want to see John Ripley at places like, we call it PR.
You know what?
Pentagon dealing with money.
I take that back. Now he could have been vectored into the special operations community, right?
Yeah.
That was his tribe.
Yeah. He very well could have, but I think even there the politics may have gotten too steep.
I know.
And Colonel Ripley was not going to go the way of politics. And there's a lot of guys like that from that era that you will see. You'll see, if you look at some of his peers, guys that have 2-3 Silver Stars, a Navy Cross, umpteen Purple Hearts, and, led platoons, companies, and battalions. Some of them had just enough savviness to be able to go to the next level. General Ray Smith, retired a 2-star general, was very much in the same cloth of Colonel Ripley. I think maybe General Smith just was able to ratchet things back a little bit, and he made general, and did good things, but you didn't see General Smith going off and doing all these Pentagon billets. He led a division, and after he led a division, I think he went over to Korea for a little while, and then that's when he bowed out.
Right. Interesting. Those guys, I have a PME that you should listen to. It's Zinni giving it at the basic school in 1989. And it is, it's the best PME I've ever been a part of in my life. I went because John Kelly, who's now the chief of staff of the White House, saw me. And there's always guys speaking at the basic school when you work there.
Sure.
And so, Colonel Tony Zinni gonna speak in what was it, Haywood Hall, the dining facility, whatever the hell it was.
Yeah.
So, Kelly sees me, and I'd been identified as going to go over to teach at IOC in a couple months, and he says, "Hey Mac, are you going to go listen to Colonel Zinni tonight?" And I said, "Sir, I don't know who he is. Should I go?" And he says, "Don't miss it." So I go. First of all, Zinni's hilarious. Okay, it's a comedy routine. In the middle of it, he talks about the PME program he did on Okinawa at 9th Marines as a regimental commander. He then says, "I had warrior nights. One night I had, I had these guys, right?" He said, "Colonel Ripley, Bill Fike, and General Van Riper is the chief of staff of three MAF at the time." He said, and so I have this panel come, and right, so we do some PME, and then we're going to have a free-for-all, and the lieutenants have at them. And he said, and, you know, you got guys like Mike Wiley, he made these lieutenants like the little mavericks, now they'll come after you. He said, and they asked these guys questions, and it was awesome because every one of them would answer them in a different way, and it kind of blew their vacuum tubes. And he says, one of the questions was helmets and flak jackets. He said, I don't believe in it. He said, for every one guy they save, it kills or wounds a bunch of guys because you're worn out, you can't hear, you can't move, you surrender operational mobility, all kinds of stuff. He said, that's a different class. I won't go into it. And he said, other guys say, oh, my flak jacket was always zipped up and my chin strap always buttoned. And then Zinni says, that's bullshit. I've never seen a picture of anybody with a zipped up flak jacket and a button helmet in my life in Vietnam, right? And everybody starts laughing, and he said one they called the Prussian, one they called the surfer, and one they called the philosopher. And Van Riper, who exudes this uptight, maybe the most uptight white guy image you've ever seen in your life, intimidating uptight white guy image in your life if you've ever been around him. Van Riper's sitting over there laughing, right? Zinni looks over and he says, don't wax your board, General. And with that, the place falls out. Just hilarious. But and Zinni, right? Zinni, one of those guys. And I'll send you the link to it. You have to listen to it. It's a PME that changed my life and a lot of lives. For instance, like, who is this guy? And I call Zinni the burning bush, right?
Yeah.
He goofs, he's smart, he's tough, he questions institutionally, he wraps in a little bit of humor and Marine Corps tradition, and he is just an example, and he's continued to be that guy, right? One of the few Marine officers who dissented about Iraq and said so in public, thought it was his moral obligation to do that. And
absolutely.
And to me, he's Tony Zinni is, in, when I, who would you say is the ideal Marine? My opinion is Tony Zinni. And guys like Tony Zinni, you know, they ran with guys like John Ripley, ran with guys like General Van Riper. I didn't understand General Van Riper. His devotion to discipline, I think, got lost in the translation. So much of it was about chicken shit and not about the substance of what he was trying to teach, and nobody bothered to explain it to me. I thought he was out of his mind. He came out, I'm in the defense, one of the basic school companies. And all of a sudden, and they just get part done with an attack. Now we're beginning to set into defense where the lieutenants are like moving all over the place because you move back and forth till we get the machine guns set in. The machine guns are getting set in. I get this phone call on my radio. Mac, primary, over. Yeah, what's up? General Van Riper, is Oscar Mike to your boss? Say again? And I'm there by myself. Normally there'll be two or three AIs. I don't know what happened to everybody else. I'm there by myself. And I said, say that again. And he said, you heard me out. And I'm like, oh shit. So I start walking back towards the road because I know his Jeep's going to pull up there. His Humvee's going to pull up there. As I get there, he's walking towards me. So he introduces himself. We shake hands. He asks about me. And he says, what am I going to see? And I tell him, and he said, here's my question for you is this anything out of the ordinary with the lieutenant class? I said, no, sir. This is about average in terms of what you see, level of discipline and level of knowledge. And he said, all right. He said, who else is out here with you? I said, I'm here by myself. He said, you want another AI? And I said, yes, sir. And he hopped in, and he started teaching machine gun gunnery classes, range cards, machine gun positioning. But that was this group of guys. They believed in the discipline. They knew about being tough. And there was this cultural fight about, were we going to be cerebral and thinkers, right? Or were we going to be hard asses like the Marine Corps had historically been? And I think I was part of a group that looked around and said, it's not an either-or proposition. It's, you got to be able to think it, but if you can think it and you can't do it, you're bullshit.
Exactly.
And if you could only do it, but you can't think it, you're just as bullshit, because you're going to be doing all the right things in the wrong spot at the wrong time. So it's not an either-or proposition. We've got to be able to do both, and that's what these guys taught. But sometimes the message got corrupted. sometimes.
Yeah, I think General Bedard was very much of the same,
yep,
the same caliber, where even as a three-star general, he could get down, you know, behind sector stakes, you know, and
they loved that shit.
Yeah.
They remember it.
You know, they cut their teeth on that stuff, right, as lieutenants in Vietnam, and it stuck with them.
Right.
And those are the guys that later will make general, and they'll do good things for the Marine Corps, but they're also the kind of guys that you wish never would have made general, because you just know that, you know, the politics kind of corrupted them a little bit. And that's why I was afraid, you know, if Ripley would have ever gone beyond being a colonel, I don't think it would have gone well for him, because I don't think he was willing to bend to that stuff.
No, you know what? And you're probably absolutely right. My guest very graciously over the course of the last, 2 hours and a half, has been Edward Neglosky. There's no F in there. Say it.
Nevglosky.
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 Nevglosky. All right. People that are interested in finding you or tracking you down, Ed, is there a way that people can find you at the Historical Division, or how do they do that?
Yeah, so come aboard Quantico if you're in this area, and come over to Marine Corps University, which is going to be down by the river, you know, over the railroad tracks. And there's a new building here called the Warner Center, built onto Marine Corps University. It's attached to the Gray Research Center, the library of the Marine Corps. And part of the Warner Center is the Simmons Wing, and that is the Marine Corps History Division is in the Warner Hall's Simmons Wing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm up on the third floor. If not, you can reach me through email, and I'll give that to you. It's Edward Echo Delta Whiskey Alpha Romeo Delta dot Nevglosky November Echo Victor Golf Lima Oscar Sierra Kilo India at usmcu.edu. So usmcu.edu. So you can email me there, edward.nevglosky at usmcu.edu. Or, hell, give me a call right here at my landline at the 703-784-3401. If I'm here, I'll answer up.
All right, you need to come back, and I'd love to talk to you about what you did in Vietnam. I think that's absolutely riveting stuff. And I hope if you don't mind, when historical issues relative to the Marine Corps come up, I haul you back on. And because, you know, for me, Ripley is the first in a series that I'll do called Legends of the Marine Corps. And I wanted to do something about Dong Ha, and I'm going to have two of his contemporaries on next week to talk about him as well. And so, Ed, first of all, thanks for kind of walking us through his career, and again, taking us down into the weeds of the events at the bridge at Dong Ha in 1972, and explaining to us some of the nuances. I appreciate all your time today.
Yeah, no problem. It was my pleasure. Anything you need from the historical perspective, Marine Corps history, give me a shout. Love to come back on. And if I can't talk about it, I got someone in this building who can. And it's always a pleasure to talk about our history, our lineage, our heritage. There's very few like us. And without us, I don't think this country will continue to exist. So we need to keep the flame alive and remember those who came before us. So semper fi to all. And yeah, I appreciate it. Time well spent.
You know, in the eulogy that his son wrote, I have a menstrual cycle, and everybody who listens knows that, and it has to do with how I can handle stuff on given days. Anybody who's I think gone to war for the country has one. Some days the thought of certain things activates my allergies and brings tears to my eyes. And other days, I can talk about them without a whole lot. I just want to read one paragraph of the eulogy that, to me, is just what I love about the Marine Corps. All right? The Marine Corps is full of people. It's filled with everybody chooses door number 4. The other 3 doors are way more enticing. Okay, an organization that has posters that say, we don't promise you shit, that is not for everybody, okay? But the people that gravitate to it, why is the Marine Corps different? Because those people are different. And when you say, let's go, boys, you don't have to look around. Let's go, boys and girls. You don't have to look around. Is everybody with us? So this paragraph to me is what is emblematic of being a Marine. In recent years, the Marine Corps saved our father's life twice. The first time, our 32nd Commandant, General Jones, provided a helicopter so that our father could receive a transplant. Time was short, and when John Ripley needed the Corps, they came through in a way that only the Corps could. The second time, few people know about. The road to recovery from the transplant was a long one. Our father was struggling. There was a commotion outside of his hospital room as an Army orderly tried to stop the four Marines from entering. Moments later, the color sergeant of the Marine Corps entered with the battle colors of the Marine Corps. The message was simple. Sir, the Commandant says that these colors are not to leave this room until you do. Those colors saved his life.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how to put that into words, right? There is an edge, a toughness, and an ability to put fear behind us as this unique group and this unique corporation moves around the world. And it's things like this and guys like John Ripley that give it its gritted teeth, its snarl, and its toughness in the face of incredible odds that day. Incredible odds that day. And our burden, as and not mine anymore, but it was, when you go to war, the long shadow of that Iwo Jima memorial casts its darkness over you. And you look and you say, I don't know what's going to happen, but this I know. I am not going to fail the Marines that depend on me, and I'm not going to let down those Marines that went before me. And those are actual tangible thoughts on airplanes headed to places like Iraq and Afghanistan and on ships headed to those places for us here in the last, 15 years. Those are actual no-shit thoughts that you have because of guys like John Ripley and the legacy that they have handed down to us. And that's why it's such a cool organization. I was telling somebody on the phone yesterday. Both my sons are in the Marine Corps. One's actually an instructor at the basic school. One's a part of 3-5. Actually, just now he's part of 5th Marine Regiment. But I said, I don't love my sons anymore because they're Marines, but I like them more because they're Marines. They will always be my sons. But I'll tell you what, I like a lot of dads. I said, look. You don't need to do this to follow in my footsteps or anybody else's, okay? This is not, it's not the most pleasant organization to work in, okay? It has to be your passion. And nonetheless, both of them saw fit to join, but I do like them more for it. I like that they're men. I like that they saw the intensity and the passion of becoming infantrymen, and that's what they became. So they both have their certified man card, and I like that. And guys like John Ripley are worthy to follow and certainly cast their long shadow. So anyway, absolutely. Ed, absolutely loved having you on today. Appreciate all the nuance that you explained, and we'll do it again.
Yep, sounds good. Give me an invite, and I'll be there.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You bet. Bye. That is Ed. That is Ski. That's how... I don't know. I have this shit going on where once I screw up a name, I have this thing. And then he says it like it's nothing. It makes me look like a jackass. Nevglosky. Oh, yeah, Mac, Nevglosky. No problem. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We'll finish up. We're like an hour and a half over, but that's okay. We can do that because I run the program. So more of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right, that's hippie music. I don't need it.
There's something happening here.
Yeah, straight up 60s music.
Is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there. Telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right.
The latest body to hit the deck after Les Moonves. This one, another one at CBS. Moonves at CBS or NBC? This guy's at CBS. Jeff Fager, F-A-G-E-R. He's the head of 60 Minutes. Has been at CBS News for 36 years. Leading figure in their news division for decades. Jeff Fager is leaving the company executive effective immediately, read a statement from CBS News President David Rhodes today. Bill Owens will manage the 60 Minutes team as Ingrid Cyprian Matthews and I begin a search for a new executive producer for the program. 60 Minutes is the most significant news broadcast on television. So stand by for that. I want to share with you something, though, that I've watched on the heels of talking about Colonel Ripley. I want to share with you and I'll put the link on the read board, and I'll put the video up there as well. But I ran across General Monday's funeral here recently, and this is a clip, and I'll do a little narrating for you. But it's awesome. He is buried in his hometown. He is buried in his hometown in North Carolina. And when we roll out our pageantry, I have to tell you, man, I love it. I absolutely love it. What you have in this small town in North Carolina, where General Mundy's buried, you have a company from 8th and I, right? You have the band down there, and you have our pallbearers, and it's incredible. The music, and when you see the Marines from 8th and I marching through this town with their M1 Grands on their shoulders in their dress blue uniforms with their white trousers, it's raining, and they're marching through, and they're perfect. They're absolutely perfect. You can see people on the sidewalk watching. And our statement about the respect that we have for our leaders, for our former commandants, and the way this looks in that small town, to include the procession. His casket is placed in a hearse, and you have it driving slowly. It has the pallbearers walking behind it. It is led by the band and the company from 8th and I, and followed by the general officers that attended, along with the Monday family. You see this, and it's absolutely, it looks awesome. Absolutely, positively awesome. So I'm gonna play this for you because I love it. So before we get out of here and you hear Hour One again, General Carl Monday, former commandant of the Marine Corps, his funeral. I have single-handedly upped the play count on this thing, I think, by about 200. How you can turn putting on a cover into a drill movement that the pallbearers do is amazing. Casket moves down the steps of the church. Pallbearers are awesome. I mean, those guys are studs.
He's from Haywood County. I'm from Haywood County, and that's really the only link that we have. I just wanted to pay my respects to a good man and a great commandant.
I've always respected the Marines. I want to be one when I get done with school. My father was in the Marines, so I really respect him. Inspiring, honestly. I want to be like the man. I want to join the Marines like that. And it's just an inspiring story, honestly. I just look up to him and my dad.
Just bystanders at the funeral. This is them marching through a small town in North Carolina. Getting ready to play Onward Christian Soldiers. It looks awesome. The other thing they do, I'll play it for you, what the hell, they drug our howitzers down there, right, to the cemetery, in this small town in the hills of North Carolina. And we do our 21 gun salute in this cemetery. It's awesome. Ospreys do a flyover. Things that we love, because we're Marines. Listen to the snap when he says present arms and everybody moves a rifle and rips it.
Present! Hut!
Nobody else loves this stuff like we do, by the way. You see people out preparing in parades, Marines are maniacs about this stuff. Our honors. All right, I'll post that link. You watch it, though. Them parading through this small town, one of the companies at 8 tonight, parading through a small town in North Carolina, the pageantry of the Marine Corps, it looks absolutely, positively awesome. Now, this little, I don't know, this 21-gun salute with artillery pieces went on down the hill, and I found this as I was watching that. This popped up. And you'll hear, so we turn artillery, right? We make the arty guys turn this into a drill movement as well. You can hear the rain. Marines in their dress blues. Wearing blue trousers, though, because they're going to get soiled. Just gave the command to post. So the arty guys go man their positions at the gun. Gave the command to load. To be told to fire, right? From the funeral itself. Howitzers look awesome.
Must be being buried up there.
That's the guy filming it. It's on somebody's camera. It looks awesome, too. I love that sound.
Call to 17.
Shut up. Kent County's from North Carolina, go figure. We'll leave on, normally I play Back in the High Life, but I'm not going to play that today. This is Onward Christian Soldiers, right, from General Monday's Funeral, dedicated to Colonel Ripley. Marine Corps is home to some incredible people. You've heard about one of them today. We'll continue to do that. We'll do. We'll continue to do the combat, the battle studies. And the other thing we'll do is we'll continue to bring people on that have experienced trauma. And I try to do that on Wednesday. So anyway, have a great day. Again, happy birthday to my youngest sister Susan. And on a Wednesday, when we learned about Colonel John Ripley, his life, his actions, his incredible actions at the Dong Ha Bridge. Thanks for listening. On that same Wednesday, All Marine Radio, over and out.